today on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Florida is closer to living up to its nickname, the Sunshine State, with the Senate passing a bill to stay on daylight saving time year-round. We'll open the lines and ask you if it's time for us to do the same. Speaking of savings, Doug Rao, longtime president of Trader Joe's, current president of the Daily Table, has figured out how to save money and food. He joins us to talk about his latest store, now open in Dudley Square. And at noon, American Prospects' Bob Kuttner joins us for his take on North Korea and what could be a diplomatic move for the ages.
In her latest column, Boston Globe Shirley Leung asks if another white man would be in charge of UMass Boston, and could it be Steve Crosby? That and more is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Offering a strategic investing approach for their clients' investments and retirement goals. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price. For over 80 years, T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence.
This is WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Friday. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there. What do you think about Newsfeed Cafe clam chowder for breakfast?
You know, we've never had it before.
It's really delicious. Nothing quite like it at 10:45 in the morning, I'll tell you.
Well, anyway, work up an appetite here reading our stories, Jim.
Really good. So, while I think Florida could still learn something from Massachusetts when it comes to stricter gun laws, I think we have a lot to learn from Florida when it comes to daylight saving time. The Sunshine State is getting a step closer to living up to its nickname. This is so exciting. With the Senate passing, and then it moves on to the governor, a bill to stay, I'm going to read this slowly, Marjorie. Mm-hmm. Daylight saving time year round. So we're opening up the lines. I think we do this about twice a year, asking you if it's time for us here in Massachusetts and New Hampshire and Rhode Island, the rest of New England, to do the same. The number is 877-301-8970. I have a number of crusades.
Yes, you do.
And I would have
this
to say,
this is one of them.
I would have to say the one of which I am probably most proud and most hopeful is extending daylight saving time for a year-round. You know, we're switching.
You haven't
2
gotten
a.m.
far
on
yet,
Sunday.
Jim.
Well, excuse me. How do you think Florida happened? I'm not saying I'm
Miami.
Solely No, I'm serious. Did you read how long it took the Senate to vote for this thing?
Right
Two
away.
Minutes.
Right away they
Two
approved it.
Minutes
I know.
They
but
approved
they have
this
to
thing.
Get a federal approval now. It has to go through Congress, the Department of Transportation, or someplace.
So Arizona and Hawaii, I think it's not all of Arizona, I'm not sure. Part of Arizona and all of Hawaii already do this 24/7. I mean, 365 days a year. And again, we do it twice a year. The arguments for, let me just list some if I can. Retail, obviously people will be out longer and spending more money because it's lighter, less energy consumption, less depression because there's more light, fewer traffic fatalities, more physical activity, crime is down. And the only argument, and by the way, there are two arguments. One, for farmers. I mean, this is not a farm economy anymore. Forget that one. Number two, the only argument that has any credibility at all, only argument, is that it's dark in the morning when little kids go to school.
That's right, but you, Jim, have a very creative solution for the travails of those little children going
well,
to school,
don't you? Well,
you
have to make fun of it. I had
yes,
a solution. I had
yes,
a solution last year, I mentioned.
This is what Jim thinks we should do, because the kids, little kids would be out in the dark waiting for the bus. He thinks they should all get taxpayer-subsidized little tiny miner's hats with little lights on the front so that they'll be able to see in the dark and others will be able to see them.
Well, by the way, that's it's better than cursing the darkness,
no,
as
I think
one
they need
once said.
Little blinking parkas for the wintertime.
No, you know
parkas,
what they should, my kid is... One of my kids has a blinking parka, but you know what? I'm serious. They do.
I did
they
not
honestly
know
do. They
there
do.
Was such a thing as
they
a
do.
Blinking
they have blinking parka. But what is my point? Oh, and the other thing is, as we've been discussing in the state forever, school shouldn't start so early anyway. So you move the school starting time up a little bit, and you've taken care of the problem. Little kids going out to go to school in the morning. And by the way, a legislative commission, and you know how much I respect commissions on Beacon Hill, approved this notion last year. What they did say is we shouldn't do it until New York and the rest of New England states do it. But did Florida wait for the rest of the Southeast? No. Mm-hmm. They decided to move, and now it's on to the federal government for approval. But, you know, in all seriousness, there are very few arguments. I'm pretty good at seeing both sides of an issue. Would you agree to that?
Well, I think that, Jim,
there's no other side to this issue.
Sometimes people wonder about the behind the scenes mm-hmm. and talk radio, how you decide these things. Mm-hmm. I think that it's fair to say that we have succumbed to Jim's obsession with setting the clocks back or moving the clocks forward for quite some time now, and twice a year we have to go through this exercise, and it's Friday before daylight savings change, and so
Excuse me, here we are again. You know how you've learned mm-hmm. nothing from these exercises? What'd you just say? What is it called?
I don't know. Move.
No,
lose
no, no.
An hour
what is
sleep
the thing
time?
That I want to do 12 months a year?
You want to have daylight savings time.
No,
daylight
I do not.
Saving
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
Okay. No
There's
S.
No S on
okay,
the
no
end of
S on the end of saving. So it's daylight saving time.
Can I? You know, the thing I don't understand, and then we'll get to the calls. You're not against this. This is another one of these. We have about one of these a week.
Yeah.
We're against something because I'm for it. You're not. Would you have a... By the way, do you remember in the middle of the winter a few months ago when we left the building, or actually you had already gone, I texted you, it was dark outside at 4:11 in the afternoon.
You know,
that is obscene.
I'm a big believer in you don't know what you got till it's gone, and I kind of love the fact that every year we get this change in time where it's going to be an hour lighter later.
What do you like about it?
Because it's wow, springtime is coming. I kind of like the darkness. I don't like the sameness.
You like darkness in the early afternoon?
I'm not
4:11?
Crazy about it. I'm not crazy about the darkness.
Well, you know what you can
early.
Do about it? Make daylight saving time 12 months a
if
year.
If you have it all the time, you just don't appreciate it. Yeah. I like the fact that this weekend, even though we're going to lose an hour of sleep, on Monday we're going to get out of work and it's going to be light out when we get out of work, and it's great. And if it's light out all the time when you get out of work, Jim, it's like living in California. Mm. You know, you don't appreciate how wonderful it is because you don't have a seasonal change.
Huh.
We have seasonal changes here. It's part of what I like about being in New England.
Okay. In the words of Emma Gonzalez, mm-hmm. I call BS on you. I mean, that is just the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard. 877-301-8970. I will bet you in the next 20 minutes that we're discussing this, I would say 80% of the people at minimum will agree with me, which is not the usual case.
And one more thing.
Yes.
You know why I like getting up in the dark?
No.
It makes me feel like efficient. Like I am mm-hmm. I am somebody who gets up in the dark in the wintertime, and I'm on top of the situation. I'm not behind. I'm industrious. That's why I like getting
Can
up in
I
the
also
dark.
Explain something? Because Marjorie mm-hmm. did this to ridicule me.
Mm-hmm.
While the
miner's
little,
hats?
While the little miner's,
little miner's
hats with lights would be taxpayer subsidized. They would not be 100% paid for by the public. 877-301-8970. You go wherever you want. Take any call you want, and they're going to agree with me. Go ahead.
Okay. Let's start with Diane in Portsmouth. Hi, Diane.
Here we go.
Hi.
Hi. Which side are you on?
I want daylight savings all year.
Okay. Daylight savings. Jim's going to – it wants to correct everybody who says it wrong. There's no S on savings.
Daylight saving all year long.
Thank you
now,
very
Diane,
much, Diane.
Now, Diane – no, we're not getting rid of Diane yet. Diane – what do you think of Marjorie's ridiculous argument that the reason we shouldn't do it is because it's fun to have change or some cockamamie thing? What do you think of that?
Well, she has her opinion, but the reason why I don't like changing is because – I like Marjorie, by the way.
Thank
so
you, Diane.
It's because every time we change the clocks, people are late for work, they're too early, they don't change their clocks, and blah, it's just silly.
Well, you know,
I don't know.
Well, by the way, Diane, you're describing inconvenience, but what I said before was not made up. There are more traffic fatalities because people are more tired when they lose that hour of sleep. There's more depression when you switch back to whatever the other thing is called.
You left out the heart attacks.
There are health consequences.
Yeah, health issues.
Diane, that was an excellent call. Thank you very much for joining us. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Denise in Rhode Island. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Denise.
I agree with
Jim is his name, yes.
Jim, yes. Mm. Yes. Especially, and the reason is because originally it was set that way for the Mainers to gather the potatoes, and everybody was out on the farm, et cetera, et cetera. And I was in upstate New York, there's a lot of farming going on there, and we still did it over there, and we still kind of growled and complained and everything else. But if we could do that, that would be great, because as you get older, you don't, appreciate the change very much
exactly.
at all.
Now, Denise, since you're on the correct side of this issue, what do you think about my notion of having little miner's hats with lights on them for children to go to school with?
The schools can rearrange their schedules exactly. as far as that goes. And also, the parents are either waiting in their cars at the bus stop.
Great point.
Regardless if the times have changed or not. They just, you know, they're helicopter parents, and they don't want anybody talking or looking
excellent
at
excellent point. Denise, thank you. That was an excellent point. The parents are going to be with little kids anyway. I haven't thought of that. So what's the big deal? We don't even need the taxpayer-funded miner's hats. No, I'm serious. Little lights on them. How much would the kids love that, by the way? This is like a little fun thing.
They would love it. I like the blinking Parker idea, too. You see some people that ride bikes, and they really are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very good thing for safety to be serious for a second, because they are blinking all over the place. But their helmets are blinking. Their belts around their waist are blinking. They got the fluorescent things on the feet going.
Okay, so Marjorie.
What?
You haven't, I assume you know, you since you haven't suggested that I'm wrong,
yeah.
It is better for the economy. It is better
okay.
for conservation. It is better for mental health. It's better for physical health. It leads to fewer traffic accidents, and crime is down. So are those pretty decent reasons
those are all
to
good
make
arguments,
a change?
Jim, but I'm really looking forward to this weekend, even though I'm going to lose an hour of sleep, because it's going to be great to get out of work on Monday and have it be light out.
Yeah.
And because it's
by the way, it's always light out when you get out of work. You leave at 2 o'clock.
Well, that's an excellent point.
I mean, I actually work a full day. That's the difference.
I'm working from home, Jim,
okay.
very assiduously.
Well, you are right in the Globe.
I am right in the Globe, Colin, that's
and
right.
And you're preparing for the next
I'm
day.
I'm preparing for the next day's show.
No,
that is correct.
She's not doing
our number
that,
is 877-301-8970. What do you think? Jim is on a crusade.
Dim?
Jim. Whoops.
Dim. That's exactly what happens
Dim,
if you don't have daylight
Dim,
saving time.
Jim is on a crusade, and he's been on this crusade now for about 20 years.
Since
he's,
I met you
he's
19
persistent.
Years ago.
He's persistent. I'll give him that much. He wants to be in
By the
same...
Way, you know who's another champion of this?
Ed Markey.
Ed Markey.
Yes,
what did
is.
Ed Markey
From
do?
From environmental reasons.
Well, exactly. And Ed Markey, one of his great, I've said this to the center, one
yep.
of his great victories in Congress was to, I think, move back the date when you dump. I hope I'm right about this.
It was longer.
It used to be that late October we got rid of daylight saving
yeah.
time. Now it's in November, thanks to Markey's
bill.
It's
in November, and I think we were early in the spring as well. Well, it's not
Maybe.
Spring yet, but I think he moved up the second week.
You might be right about that.
The second
that.
Sunday in March, which it did not.
Excellent
which it
point.
Did not used to be. Let's go to Robert in the car. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Excellent.
Hey, Jim, you're so unfair to people who live differently than you.
He is.
How so?
Like the gap early. Get up early and go to bed early. If anything, they should reverse it. They should make it so that it gets lighter earlier all the time.
So wait a second. So I'm unfair to people who want to go to bed early. What does that mean? You go to bed at 4 o'clock in December because it gets dark? Is that what I'm denying you?
You want to get an early start on the day.
And the summertime, it's still light at 9, and I want to be in bed by then. And I feel guilty about going to bed at when it's still light out.
Okay, Robert, that's not a great argument, but it's 2-1 so far. Robert, thank you very much for your call. We're going to continue
okay,
this,
we're
going to
talk about this because this is our indulgence of Jim
me.
Twice
not
a
indulgence.
Year. His fixation on staying with daylight saving time, not savings, saving
thank
time.
You.
I'm going to keep talking about it. The number is 877-301-8970. You are listening to Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live on Fridays. We always do on Friday from the Boston Public Library.
The invention of modern sleep. That's right, the invention. I'm Kara Miller. That's next time on Innovation Hub.
Saturday at noon on WGBH Radio.
Saturday evening, play along as Massachusetts high schoolers go head-to-head in a battle of the brains. Don't miss a new episode of WGBH's High School Quiz Show, Saturday evening at 6 on WGBH2.
This is Boston Public Radio on WGBH, made possible thanks to listener contributions. Your support of just $10 or $20 a month keeps all these great conversations coming your way. Please take a moment to give now at WGBHnews.org or call 888-897-9424.
Okay. Right now, when you support WGBH for $12 a month, backed by popular demand, we're going to thank you with the new Boston Public Radio Smug Mug.
The return of the Smug Mug. That's
Why
right. What does
is
that
it
mean?
Called the Smug
exactly.
Mug, you may ask? Well, It's smugness part two, because whenever we have these pictures of Jim, no matter where they seem to be, he's got his nose up in the air looking at everybody smugly. We had one before. Smugness
sold
continues.
Out, by the way. It was huge. It was the biggest the item we ever had.
Smug mug is on offer. And so we've got a combo, actually. Dean's Beans combo. It's a great cup of coffee. Only till noon, you're going to get the Dean's Beans and the BPR Smug Mug, a contribution of $12.50 a month. And we'll thank you with both of those things. Only, like I said, until 12 o'clock. We also have the one with the GBH BPR logos and the phrase live, local, and highly caffeinated on the side of the Smug Mug. But the big feature is this really obnoxious picture of Jim looking very smug. Black 15 ounces IMAX style mug. The number is 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
Two things. One, the twofer, as Marjorie said, the inclusion of Dean's Beans, their slogan being brew great coffee, create great real courage, that's only a part of the deal till noon. The mug thing lasts till 2. By the way, my agent, who unfortunately happens to be your agent too, I've asked him to find me a lawyer. This, you look like a movie star. You really look like
a
movie star.
They did a nice job
it's
there with
the
makeup.
It's a photo from Boston Magazine.
Yeah.
And I look like the biggest a-hole in the history of Earth.
Well, I think they captured the essence, Jim.
Return of the Smug. By the way, this really was the most, sadly, the most popular item in last year's pledge.
They flew out of here like hotcakes.
$12.50 a month, and you get the Return of the Smug mug. And again, that only till noon, in addition to the Smug mug for $12.50 a month, you get great coffee. Actually, we shared some, Marjorie and I, the other day, Dean's Beans. Great,
yeah, it's great.
Fabulous coffee. South Central America, Asia. There's this thing where essentially you get, we should make it clear, 3 months of it. First month from South or Central America, then Asia, and then the final month from Africa. The coffee is great. It's a great deal. $12.50 a month or $150 all at once, at least until my lawyer gets a restraining order. 888-897-9424 or WGBHnews.org. You know, in all seriousness, that is like the best picture of you. It's the one from Boston Magazine.
I'm very happy about the picture.
It is gorgeous.
So let me tell you, if you have the first Smug mug, here's what you can do. You can kind of have a smuggier contest. You can look at a smug number two, smug number one, and decide in which picture Jim looks more condescending toward all the rest of us.
It's really horrible. It's in all seriousness. I mean, it is really, you know, it's bad enough that luckily they're on different sides of the mug, so we're not side by side. But could they have picked a less attractive photograph
of
me?
You know what I think, Jim?
What?
I think someone around here thinks you're pretty smug. No matter what picture you wind up looking smug on the mug.
You know what one of our colleagues just said?
What?
Said that Marjorie looks like a lost Renaissance portrait.
Exactly.
It is totally true.
That's right. That's right.
It's
Call me a Caravaggio girl.
Okay, go
anyway,
ahead.
Jennifer in Arlington, Linda in Whitensville, Christopher in Biddeford Pool, Maine. Thank you very much for contributing. And I tell you what, until noon, like Jim said, you can get this unbelievable mug. You can really have some good time laughing at it. It's a new BPR mug.
It's not funny.
Plus 3 months supply of Dean's coffee, Dean's Beans coffee.
Great coffee,
it is great coffee. Jim gave me some, and it is fantastic. The number again, 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Mardrigan broadcasting live. We're now here 3 days a week at the Boston Public Library. Tuesdays, Wednesdays we've added, and Friday. If you're tuning in, we're making our biannual inquiry, asking you if you support, which I do, changing the clocks. Essentially, we should go the way of Florida and never change the clocks. Adopt what's called, I think it's Atlantic Standard Time. It would be daylight saving time. 12 month a year.
Instead
and in all seriousness.
Eastern Standard Time, right?
Or whatever it is. I don't even know what they're called. But all I know is you wouldn't have to do this back and forth thing. And in all seriousness, I really have done a lot of research on this. I've written about this. I've thought about it a lot. The only argument is early days, kids going to school in the dark. And as two callers have said, one, the parents are with them anyway. And two, they shouldn't be going to school so early anyway. This should provide an impetus for the legislature or local school committees, whatever it is, to have a later starting time for little kids, just like they're talking in Boston about having a later start time for high school kids. End of discussion, and we'll have light 12 months a year.
Okay, let's go to Tim in Portsmouth. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
So I call when you have this show. I call every year.
Yeah.
And I rail about Ed Markey. And I rail about Jim Brody.
Oh, good.
I'm a morning person. But you know what? I'm willing to concede defeat to you people who can't get up in the morning, who have to have the evening light because they don't want to get out of bed when it's beautiful out at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm conceding so that we don't have to go through the change anymore.
So you're giving up? Wait, are you giving up on this fight?
I'm giving up. You know why, Jim?
Why?
It's the same reason I told you last year when I called. I have an east-west 50-mile commute. I live in the center of New Hampshire, of center of southern New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and I'm calling you from my work in Portsmouth, and I just went through the sun in my face, and now I have to do it all over again. I'm tired of it.
Oh, on your way to and your way home.
That's particularly bad on the way to, because I'm a working person, a blue-collar person, a tradesman. So unlike you guys that go to work at 8 or 9 o'clock, I have to be on the road when the sun comes up.
Well, I think there's, you know, Tim, I respect you a lot, and I think I've a practical solution for you is just get a new job. I mean, Tim, thank you for your biannual call, and thank you for conceding.
That's awful.
That the fight
having
is almost
drive
over.
Into
it
the
is
sun
horrible.
On your way to and into the
probably
sun on your way
have
home.
Sunglasses, by the way, and visors on the car.
Yeah, I know, but it's still hard to see sometimes. And by the way, in your defense, you are an early riser. I mean, I'm the one. Yeah, you get up at the crack of dawn.
And when do I get to work early?
You get to work about 2 hours earlier than I do every day.
Thank you. It's really upsetting
because you're kind of ruining the curve. You know what
thank
I mean,
you,
Jim?
I do indeed.
Let's go to Janice in the car. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Janice. What's up?
Hi.
Hi. You're on.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I am against 12 months a year.
Oh, good.
Daylight saving time.
Thank you. I finally got one, Janice. Thank you.
I also am an early riser, early to bed. I fall asleep somewhere between 8:30 and 9 and wake up at 5.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And while I hate the sun in my eyes in the morning, I like the change.
That's what Marjorie said, yeah.
It wakes me up. It reminds me that I'm still around.
Well, what do you mean? You're not going to be around if it turns out we had daylight saving time 12 months?
I'm getting old.
Oh. Yeah.
I'm in the 70 area.
Oh. Okay.
And I like the change.
Okay, we hear you, Janice. Thank you very much.
I do, too. I like the
change.
Oh,
I heard you say that, Marty.
It's a big thing to
me. And the reason for it is what?
Because I think if you have the same thing all the time, you begin to lose appreciation for it. And I've said this before.
You don't really believe that, by the way, do you?
Yes, I do. That's part of why I didn't like California. Because it's the
same. You went to college here for 3 years.
I know, and I was very homesick because it's the same all the time. They say they have a change of seasons in Northern California, and they sort of do. I mean, it gets down like 60 degrees, but it's not really a big deal. The trees don't change colors.
No.
It's not like around here. We have the beautiful fall to look forward to, the beautiful lush humidity to look forward to.
That's
some
true.
People hate the humidity. I love
no,
the humidity.
No, when you're in California, you miss the notion that your trees in your front lawn are uprooted and fall in your house. Now, that is something that I would miss if I lived in California.
Yeah, and you have earthquakes and wildfires.
Well, what do earthquakes have to do with daylight saving time?
Well, nothing, but what are the trees falling?
Weather. It was this violent weather.
What does weather have to do with daylight saving
Absolutely
time,
nothing.
Jim?
Actually nothing.
Okay.
Now that I think
my number is 877.
No, you said you were talking about seasons. Your point was you like seasonal changes, too.
I like seasonal changes.
Okay.
I like seasonal changes, and they're very distinct in New England, needless to say.
By the way, this is much closer this year than it normally is, which is troubling to me.
We have to get to Ann, because Ann in Acton thinks Jim is wrong, so we have to talk to her right away.
Why would that be, Ann?
Well, I can't believe that you've been doing this for 19 years.
You
have been doing it for 19 years, and Marjorie is right. In California, if you have sun all the time, you have to go outside and play all the time, so you don't have a time. There's no time to work.
Exactly.
But Jim, if you really want the sun to be like you are saying, move to a different latitude.
Yeah.
I knew that's where you were going there.
I remember going to England when I was in college, and I was there in the springtime, and it was light till like 10 or 11 o'clock at night, which I sort of liked. But
can I explain to you and Anne, though? You don't have to go outside because the light is out.
Yeah.
But you can go outside and not worry as much about crime. There is much more physical activity, which is makes us healthier.
Right.
If the light is available longer, they're all good things. I mean, I hear you, Anne, but I'm not.
Yeah, but coming from New England, if it's sunny all the time.
Yeah.
If it's sunny out all the time, you feel compelled to go outside.
You do.
Can't stay inside.
You know, that is an excellent point, and it's really hard if you live in a place like that and you're in college, like, to study because you feel like it's so beautiful. There's something about hunkering down that's great about the dark and the cold.
There is?
Yes.
Like, and
cozy.
Thanks for the call. Hunkering down because of the cold is a good thing?
Well, it makes you appreciate when you're able to go out. And I mean,
why were you late for work the other day?
Which other day?
Didn't you have some? I thought you had. Oh no, actually, it wasn't you. It was Chelsea. Heating problem.
Oh yeah, I have a plumbing problem today. The plumbers are at my house right now.
Really? So let's make your final argument because time is up, and I'll make mine.
Mostly, Jim. I'm really tired of you talking about this, and I will be on the opposite side. No matter what happens.
No, it's good you say that because it's not important that the economy get better, that we conserve more energy, that we have less we have less depression, fewer traffic accidents, more physical activity, and crime goes down. Those aren't that important,
You know what that is, Jim?
What is it?
Fake news.
Fake news. Thank
Coming
you,
up,
Margaret.
Doug Rao.
We're going to do this again in 6 months.
Yeah, we're
going
to do it.
Win.
I know. We do it twice a year, and it's really getting a little old, Jim, but we'll keep plowing ahead.
Thank you.
Coming up, Doug Rao, a pioneer in saving food waste and selling healthy, affordable food, joins us for a status update on the Daily Table. If you hadn't heard about the Daily Table, you're really going to be fascinated. He's just opened his second store in Dudley Square. Doug Rao is next. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
You know, Marjorie. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Doug Rao has taken something that, admit it, we all do in private, and he's turned it into a public good. I'm talking about eating food that is past its expiration date, or close. Rao is taking foods, produce, canned goods, dairy, that are on the brink of expiring and selling them at a fraction of the cost. These foods are healthy, they're safe, and if you buy their prepared meals, it tastes pretty good, too. It's all at the Daily Table. He opened up his first store in Dorchester a couple of years ago. His new one is in Roxbury. It opened in January. Doug is founder and president of the Daily Table. He's also the former president of Trader Joe's. We haven't seen you in a while. Doug, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming back.
Great to see you, Jim. Good to see you, Marjorie.
Well, before we ask you about the Daily Table, I feel liberated because after the first time I talked to you, I said, I'm going to try it, you know. And the yogurts and the cheeses and the things that say there. You're absolutely right. They're good for days and days and days after they say you shouldn't buy them anymore. So I have a new attitude toward my dairy products in any case. But tell people who don't know, what's the Daily Table?
Yeah, so Daily Table basically is a retail store. It's, as you mentioned, down in Dorchester and one in Roxbury now, that is designed around, let's bring affordable, nutritious, healthy foods to everybody in the community, because 1 in 8 Americans are food insecure. They struggle. They can't really afford to eat the foods they should be eating. And we know that as a result of that, we've got, you know, massive issues of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, in these communities. And particularly when it comes to kids, it's heartbreaking. So what we do is we looked at, well, how can we possibly afford to go down there and get really good, you know, fruits and vegetables, clean dairy and protein, grab-and-go meals that, you know, are nutritious and tasty, at prices that are economically viable and compete with junk food.
Yeah, so, with fast food, right?
Basically. Yeah, it's cheaper, actually.
So you wouldn't be going to McDonald's and you'd be going to your place.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, you could go into a Daily Table today, and we have a kitchen that cooks fresh every day, stuff there, and you can get a dinner that has you know, several pieces of chicken, brown rice, and some vegetables, whatever we have for that day, for $1.99. And, you know, this is freshly prepared. It tastes good. Etc. So Daily Table's designed around, can we try to assist this challenge that's in America about how do we provide everyone with the foods they should be eating as an option? Now, not everyone, you know, I mean, not everyone will choose to eat well. That's something that's true throughout all the economic spectrum, but you want to at least give them the opportunity and the chance.
By the way, I've had the prepared food from your kitchen. It is spectacular, and it really is high quality, tastes good, all that sort of stuff. But Janelle Nanos wrote a piece the other day in the Globe about, you know, round two, about the Roxbury store, and she mentioned, which I was unaware of actually, Doug, that you had hit a bump in the road vis-a-vis this thing Marjorie and I talked about a minute ago, vis-a-vis expired food, at least technically expired date food, which was still perfectly fine. Describe the bump and how you circumvented it.
Well, so the bump was that the original idea was having spent my career in the food industry, I knew that food at the sell-by or best-by date isn't their expiration date, that the food's perfectly safe. That's a if a grocer's going to sell you something, a gallon of milk or a quart of yogurt, and it's got a sell-by date of today on it, they don't expect you to run home and drink a gallon of milk tonight. So it's got a large window on that. But because of that, we are literally throwing out in landfills millions of pounds of food a year. So not one in 100 Americans understand code dates, and I understand that. It's a tough battle. So I went out into the city. I thought, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and collect this food, bring it down, and offer it because it's still healthy and safe. Two bumps. One was, of course, this issue. And one of the things about Daily Table that's really key to us is, can we tackle the issue of hunger or food insecurity in a manner that gives a dignified exchange for the people we interact with? So when you're in a retail format, your customer employs the purse, so they got the power. So they come in, they choose things, they feel like it's, hey, I'm providing for my family. It's a much more dignified exchange. So one was that issue of code dates. As much as I went out to the neighborhood and talked and talked and talked, I realized I was kind of up against the issue of, you know, I feel like I'm getting maybe a secondhand product.
Yes.
So we had initially already decided, okay, for the first 90 days, let's make sure we just have maybe shorter code, but still in code, perfectly good product, first-rate product. What really happened, though, was right before we opened, the Boston Health Department made a decision, a declaration that nobody, and this wasn't based on Daily Table, just it was based on what happened with the Boston Public School System, I remember, where they got themselves.
That was John Connolly's big issue before he ran for mayor against Marty Walsh.
I think they were like 6 and 9 months and years.
Exactly. Yeah. And now the interesting thing about that is, to my knowledge, no single kid ever got sick.
Yeah.
And was never reported. Yet they're eating foods that were months past its code date. But it so freaked everyone out that the Boston Health Department said, okay, that's it. Nobody under any circumstances can handle, carry, distribute, or sell product past its code date. And as much as I talked to them about, well, look, let's look at the science, we'll work with you, it was an uphill. It was swimming up Niagara Falls.
So what'd you do?
So instead, we moved upstream to the manufacturing level. So, for instance, if you're Ready Pack or you're Stonyfield or you're Cedars and you've got hummus or yogurt, you can't ship that to a grocer when there's sometimes, it depends upon the product, there's anything from months to weeks left on the code. Mm-hmm. So to a manufacturer, their expiration date is weeks of still perfectly good code. So we go up and pick up from them regularly product that would have been disposed of, or we'll buy it at pennies on the dollar, and we do with Chobani and Ready Pack and many other companies. And that product then comes into the store. It's offered at extreme discounts so that it becomes SNAP eligible, becomes SNAP affordable. And as a result, people can get in code perfectly good product that we were able to get either for pennies on the dollar or donated, and we can get out to the community. You know, what now has been, we do about 600,000 servings a month out of Dorchester now, about 1.2 million servings between the two stores. We got a little closer, about 30,000 members. And what's really, to me, what's really rewarding is, and every time I'm in the store, there's these goosebump stories of people coming and talking about how their kids are eating better, how much weight they lost, or how they literally, a man came in and said, I'm off diabetic medication. I've been off for a year
fabulous.
Simply by eating your food.
Hey, by the way, we should say, if you didn't say it right, this is a nonprofit operation. Is
that's
that
correct.
Not correct? And one of the things...
Intentionally.
that's a good line. You know, one of the things that, of the many things, and we'll come back in a minute and continue to describe this, the Daily Table story, but you also put out this wonderful thing that shows that even on the limited food stamp budget that so many people are on, and hopefully it will not be cut as much or at all, but as much as the Trump administration is proposing, you say specifically what you can buy on $45 a week that is healthy, filling, tastes good, all that sort of stuff. So it's not just this abstract thing, but rather specific meals and ingredients that can get you through the month for an affordable kind of thing, right?
Well, it's one of the benchmarks we used as to whether we're really delivering on our mission is, can someone, a person, and SNAP's very complicated, but if you're unemployed and you're a single woman or you have a child, can you come in and get 2,000 calories a day of food that you should be eating that's, you know, nutritionally from our world-class med ed here in the city, nutritional guidelines? Can you get the food you should be eating, 2,000 calories a day, and end up with money in your pocket at the end of the month? And we make sure that we have, every time we've tested that, we have validated that we can get someone to the end of the month on SNAP. We think we're the only food store, frankly.
Well, let's just be clear. Food stamp is not just for unemployed people, as you know. A lot of low-income people that just can't afford it are getting
the majority,
subsidized
the majority
as well
gets
they should.
That's right.
We're talking with Doug Rau. He's the founder of the Daily Table. We're going to keep talking to him about this and ask what you do about cheapskates sneaking into the Daily Table. That's what I want to know. The conversation continues on 89.7
like
WGBH,
me.
Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
If you listen to Boston Public Radio 3 hours a day, that's 15 hours a week, 60 hours a month, and 720 hours a year. Maybe it's time you pitched in. Call 888-897-9424 or give online at wgbhnews.org.
Oleanas.
Excuse
Not
me,
bad.
Marjorie, you're talking to your friends. We're
Oops,
on the radio.
I'm
this
sorry.
Is Pledge Break. Why don't you talk about the return of the smug
I'm
mug?
Sorry, I was talking to a friend of yours just came by,
friend
Jim.
Of yours, too,
That's
Marjorie.
Right, a friend
it's
of
okay.
mine, too. That's right. So this is the opportunity that hundreds have been waiting for, if not thousands have been waiting for, the return of the smug mug.
No, that
it's
you've
only
been
gonna
waiting
be,
for.
It's only going to be available today between now and noon. You've only got a little bit more than 15 minutes left. You can get not only the smug mug, but the Dean's Beans Coffee, Brew Great Coffee, Create Real Courage. Dean's Beans Coffee, 3-month supply. That's between now and noon for $12.50 a month, the sustainer pledge. You can get both the Dean's Beans coffee, 3-month supply, and the fantastic smug mug. And that is a picture of Jim looking not only smug, but slippery, slithery. He looks very
horrible.
Suspicious, very suspicious in this picture. And the question is, why would our colleagues want to put the picture of Jim on the smug mug? And I think you can only ask after listening to the show, why not?
Exactly.
So anyway,
okay,
888-897-9424 is the number. WGBHnews.org is the website.
And I hope Marjorie made clear there, this 3 months of Dean's Beans, only for another 16 minutes.
Yep.
You got to ask for it when you order the return of the smug mug. And if you want to join me in the litigation that I'm bringing against GBH because of the photograph, it's fine. Just text me independently and we'll do it. $12.50 a month, which is a great deal as a sustainer. $150 in a single pop. All you have to do, it takes maybe a minute or two, is call 888-897-9424 or go to WGBHnews.org. It's the biggest smile you've had on your face like in months.
I predict these are going to be collector's items. I think all over New England, people are going to say, do you have a smug mug?
Okay, fine.
And when you see the smug mug, you'll know why they want them. 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. Just 15 minutes left to get both the smuggiest mug you've ever seen and the Dean's Beans coffee.
Perfectly good food is left to rot in fields, often just because of the labor it costs to collect and distribute it.
Oh, I thought there was more to the soundbite. That is our guest. That is Doug Rau. He's doing a TED Talk about the Daily Table and the whole concept of food waste, and Doug is back with us. You know, Doug, and he now has the Daily Table, not just in Dorchester, but one opened, a month and a half ago or something, pretty much at... In Roxbury. This waste thing, when I read the numbers, I know you're featured in one of Anthony Bourdain's movies, Wasted, or whatever the thing was called. What is it in the United States? Somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% of the food we produce ends up getting wasted. Is that right?
Yeah,
can we turn on Doug's mic, please?
There you go.
Go ahead, Doug.
Wow. Somewhere between 33 and 40%. And it's hard to track because much of that occurs in the house. And retailers, frankly, don't like to necessarily be fully transparent about this for reasons that are obvious. And so it's hard to get the real numbers. There's an organization called ReFED. Any of your listeners want to really get the most current information.
R-E-F-E-D.
R-E-F-E-D.com, I believe. It might be .org. I forget right now. I think it's .com. But ReFED's done the recent research funded by Rockefeller and all these others. And it's eye-opening to see how staggering it is.
You know, I'm sure when you were here, I don't know, a year ago, whenever you were here last, I asked the same question. I think you agreed with me. What you and people like you have got to do, I assume we got to help, is there's got to be a cultural shift about this notion about when food continues to be good. Because we've all been bred to believe those dates are sacred. All of a sudden, if you eat it, mold's going to grow in your esophagus or some such thing. Is anybody doing that? Or is it such in the industry, interest of the food industry to make you believe that you got to toss that stuff and buy new stuff? That we're never going to overcome it.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's the food industry, some diabolical conspiracy.
Oh,
I think
right,
it's
you were
more,
in that industry, weren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I was.
Forgot
so,
about
okay,
that.
Yes.
Yes.
No, but in all fairness, when I started with Trader Joe's, eggs weren't refrigerated, and no one was dying.
Because, is that really true?
Yeah, of course it's true. You're old enough to. No offense.
Matt, thank you very
much. No offense. As a young man as you could probably remember there were grocery stores and eggs weren't refrigerated in America.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and second is that almost no product had open code dates. For instance, bottles of water now have open code dates, like they're going to go bad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, looking for it. It has a BB, like Best Buy.
And
all of this, you can, in a way, trace to Tylenol and to the tamper evident and the fears we've had for the last 35 years around food and food safety and traceability. So there's been a rush to open code. And with that open code didn't come the education that said, and then when we pick Best Buys, I mean, let's face it, a can of tuna, and the industry will tell you, is good for years or decades, mm-hmm. unless there's something wrong with the can. But they got to put a short code on it. So if you have a can of tuna that's up against its code, most people go, oh, my God, something horrible happened to me if I eat it. And the reality is, no. Unless the can's leaking or there's something wrong, that product will be good for years.
You know, Doug, this is such an obvious and good idea. And you opened the original one in Dorchester, what, 2.5 years ago or something?
Just about three.
And then Roxbury. Are there questions of economic viability that have caused there not to be more of the, I know your goal is to have these around the country. Why are they not springing up all around the country? I mean, the need is clearly there.
Right.
The concept is brilliant and obvious. Why?
Well, one, it's tough. Although we talk about that there's 30 to 40% of food, it's not like it's waiting somewhere for a truck to go pick it up.
Yeah.
So one, it's tough. It's out in fields. It's in, thousands of manufacturing and stores things. So going and getting it's tricky. Second is it's a business that is not the simplest to run. So we actually, I think, are bordering on world class on returning a philanthropic dollar for the return you get, because we cover about 66 to 67% of our expenses off our own activity, moving toward with the second store 80, 85%. We hope with the third store to be break even. But it's tough. It's been tough. Honestly, this is like the toughest endeavor I personally have undergone. Even when I brought Trader Joe's to the East 21 years ago with a wonderful team, that was challenging. But this is a real challenge. There is a growing movement in America that's becoming aware of this challenge. I do think that Gen X and millennials and others are going to start pushing more and more towards companies and us as consumers to become more aware of what's this really mean and should we be tossing this?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of millennials, this is a gross generalization, but they're much more into food than I ever was when I was in my 20s. But I'm going to ask you about people taking advantage, the cheapskate thing. I mean, people that maybe are making 100 grand, but they found out you've got $1.99 takeout food and they're down there taking advantage of that. Do you get much of that or not?
We don't.
And
the reason we know it is IRS had the same concern, frankly.
Yeah.
And we struggled with them for several years in a fight to get the 501c3 nonprofit status. But they agreed. They said, we love the mission. We get it. But what's going to keep a busload of yuppies, this is their term, from coming down from Newton every day, buying out all these great deals, and then you don't have anything for the local community?
Is that why they asked for my zip code? I'm serious.
Bingo.
Is that the reason?
That's the reason. So what happens is IRS said, you've got to be able to track and, if necessary, restrict who shops are. And we said, all right. So we came back. We said, what if we zip code track? And then if it's required, we'll restrict. And they said, all right, we love it. Let's go with it. So
you haven't needed
basically
it.
We have a IRS-mandated requirement to have members. And all you have to do, as you know, is give your zip code that you live in and a cell number or some other number that you come up with that when you walk up becomes your identification number. And that way we can track where our customers are coming from. Now, to date, 85, 90% are coming from the areas contiguous in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Okay.
So if Bill Gates or Warren Buffett want to come down and shop, in addition, of course, to anyone else present,
they're welcome.
And the attitude is every shopper's a funder. And frankly, our customers down there like seeing people that could have gone somewhere else. Because think about it. It adds to the validity of, hey, this is good food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just for, you know.
You know what else I'm really interested in? I looked at some of the
restricted
recipes and the food you can have, on the SNAP budget. But I'm interested in the feedback you get on the prepared food, because one of the things I think most mothers can appreciate, I mean, dads too, but oftentimes it's mothers, you're so tired at the end of the day, you got three little kids, it's easy to get a pizza or to get something that's not very nutritious because you're tired. So what do you hear about the actual prepared food from mothers?
You heard from me a couple of minutes.
If it impacts people's mealtime, because if you can just get dinner for $1.99, for three people, that's pretty cheap, and it's good food, and it saves you from giving them you know, fish sticks or mozzarella sticks are the bad things I used to give my poor children.
And actually, we put in a kitchen commissary, not because it was originally in the plan, but by going out and doing focus groups and meeting with church groups and neighborhood communities, they came back with the one thing is that, hey, most of those 1 in 8 Americans that are struggling have jobs, they work, and they buy food. But at the end of the day, they work 2 or 3 jobs.
Yeah.
They take public transportation. Yeah. They don't have any time.
Exactly.
All of America is short on time. I think I told you guys this before. It's a staggering statistic. 80% of Americans have no idea what's for dinner at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
No, that is amazing.
So anyway, what happens is they now can come in and know that they get. And so they told us, if you really want a service, have grab-and-go meals that are going to be no more than we pay for elsewhere because we can't step up. There's no such thing as disposable income, that term that's often used. I had to learn years ago that there's trade-off income when you're dealing in communities that are struggling. There's no disposable income. So what they've told us is open kitchen that can have, grab-and-go, ready-to-eat meals that we can go take home, we can buy, that in 3 to 5 minutes are ready. So as a result, this, it runs anywhere from 20-30% of our sales, but probably drives 50-60% because when they're in there, they also get, bananas for the next day for the kid or apples because we sell bananas, 29 cents a pound, the cheapest rice anywhere. And, and stuff like that. So,
by the way, people are emailing saying where the store is. Marjorie's going to give the
Dudley Square.
I mean the specific address. Marjorie's going to give the website before we leave. Can you, before you leave, settle the dispute that Marjorie and I have been had for? Because you mentioned the egg thing, that when you started in the business, eggs weren't refrigerated. Yeah. We debate, I'd say, 5 times a year whether you need to refrigerate mayonnaise. And Marjorie is, I'm not going to tell you which side either of us are on. What's the answer to the question, Doug Rowe?
Well, the answer to the question, in my opinion, is that once it's opened, you should refrigerate it by the way it's produced today.
You are such a gloater, Marjorie.
I am. I'm a gloater. That's what I said.
What do you mean the way it's produced? What does that mean?
Well, for instance, if you put egg in mayonnaise, which by definition, you have egg in there, that protein is what the problem is. It's not the oil. The oil's not a problem or any of the other things. It's that egg that when it's not refrigerated, once it's opened and raw like that, it's like any other. If you put an egg out on a counter and you let it just sit there, would you eat it in 4 days? I don't think so.
There you go, Jim.
Well, he doesn't know what he's talking
about,
obviously. Why did I ask you? What do you know about food, Doug?
But I like daylight saving year-round.
You're the man.
Okay.
Doug Rao, congratulations.
Quite a diplomat
as well. The project is great. Daily Table
is
great.
Very diplomatic.
We're thrilled to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Good luck with everything.
The website, by the way, dailytable.org, give you all the information, dailytable.org. And the man who founded Daily Table and is president of Daily Table, Doug Rao, was just with us. Thank you very much, Doug Rao. To learn more about this, like I said, dailytable.org. Up next, Robert Kuttner is here for his take on Trump's unprecedented leadership and if it could mean historic diplomacy with North Korea. We're also going to talk about the president's tariffs. Robert Kuttner is joining us next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Noon on today's BPR live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. At his UN debut, Trump said Rocket Man Kim Jong-un was on a suicide mission and that the U.S. would have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. But as North Korea's charm offensive turned dystopic prospects into a diplomatic coup, American Prospects' Bob Kuttner joins us for that, plus his take on what we're all missing when it comes to Trump's trade war.
Today marks the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. By that, I mean the famed Fearless Girl statue holding her own in a man's world. Boston Globe business columnist Shirley DeYoung joins us for that and more. Then Callie Crossley joins us to explain how a $4,000 evening gown can actually be a sign of frugality. Then we top it off with a Friday news quiz, a pledge edition featuring WGBH's Henry Santoro and Andy Hicks. That and more is coming up on Boston Public Radio.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able. But hopefully, this will not be necessary.
And maybe it won't be necessary. This is Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. We're broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. That was Donald Trump making his UN debut last fall. Since then, many incendiary exchanges, inflammatory tweets, and successful ICBM launches have followed. But could Kim Jong-un's, let's call it, charm offensive actually be turning the potential for Armageddon into nuclear disarmament? Joining us for his take on this is Robert Gutner. He is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. His forthcoming book, coming out in early April, is Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? Bob Gutner, it's good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, great to see you again, Bob Gutner. So many Trump critics, including one like myself, have been very excited about the possibility of not feeling that we're about to get into an Armageddon situation with North Korea, and that we do have a possibility now with the president negotiating with North Korea. So I know you've written extensively about this, Bob. Tell us what you think.
Well, what's interesting is that leaving aside Trump's bombast and instability, this is essentially the same offer that the North Koreans have been making to American presidents going back to Clinton. That is, you guarantee us some security, and we will relent on nukes. It's an arms control offer, and stripped of the theatrics, the question is whether Trump has the competence as a diplomat. It's almost hard to use those two words in the same sentence to pull off an arms control agreement that would have some durability. What's doubly interesting is that this is a left of center South Korean regime, which is interested in its own terms in pursuing some kind of a detente with the North. So you've got a kind of a three-way dance here just at a moment when Trump is provoking a trade war with the South Koreans.
Over the tariff issue.
Over the tariff issue. So a lot of moving parts here. Not the world's greatest diplomat. And I think a lot of people who follow this more closely than I do are convinced that this is just a feint, a stunt on the part of Kim to pull Trump into this. And the devil will be in the details in terms of whether a real arms control mutual restraint agreement is possible.
But, you know, the old adage you always hear that, you know, post-World War II idea that if we're trading with each other, we're not going to blow each other up kind of thing.
I think he was scoffing at that comment.
So the idea that we would be, it seems to me the idea that the President of the United States would at least be talking to the President of North Korea is a good thing. You're not convinced.
Well, it beats blowing each other up.
Yeah.
But I mean, given the personalities of these two people.
Right.
You can't predict the outcome. I mean, they could come away from this hating each other more than they do going in. If it were two more normal people who had divergent national interests as states, you might, I mean, think about Gorbachev and Reagan.
Yeah.
You know, you might, and again, it was very improbable that Reagan would be the one to achieve a kind of a breakthrough, but he did.
He did.
But he's rather more stable than Trump, and unlike Trump, Reagan actually listened to his advisors. So on the one hand, you can imagine the outlines of a deal, a mutually beneficial deal. On the other hand, there are probably not two more improbable people capable of cutting that deal.
You know, when you mentioned how important the diplomats are, the statement that came out of Ed Markey last night was along those lines. It's really important, particularly on the short time schedule, which where they're apparently going to meet as early as May, that the diplomats get involved. But the part of yesterday that was most troubling to me, not that Rex Tillerson has distinguished himself in any fashion, is I assume people listening know that yesterday morning, I think it was, he is quoted as saying, I think he's in Ethiopia, we are a long way from negotiations with the North Koreans. We are a long way from direct talks. And just hours later, the guy to whom he reports announces face-to-face meetings with Kim Jong-un. And I laughed, as you did, but it speaks to the fact that this is almost a rogue operation. When you read the New York Times story, the guy, the national security guy from South Korea happened to be in the White House. He was supposed to meet with Trump today. Trump heard he was in the White House, called him in the office. The guy says to Trump, oh, by the way, Kim Jong-un wants to meet with you. Okay, let's do it. And an hour later, the announcement is made. So in light of the Tillerson exclusion, in light of the fact that I don't think we have a new ambassador to South Korea, do we? We don't. You're agreeing that I'm right. Our whatever that person is, liaison envoy to North Korea, there isn't one as of the moment. Is there the infrastructure, even if Trump wants to use diplomacy, to pull this thing off?
Well, we're in completely uncharted territory here. I mean, normally, when you think about how arms control agreements have been negotiated in the past, you know, there's an enormous amount of preliminary work.
Before the leaders meet.
At the level of the working diplomats who really understand the logic of mutually assured destruction, and they talk about what kind of a deal might be possible. It's almost never done at the very top first. Now, one exception to that is Reagan and Gorbachev, where Reagan departed from the script and felt that this was at Reykjavik in 86, I think, that there was, you know, there was a need for a breakthrough. And then the diplomats were given their marching orders to let's see how we can make this work. But I don't really think it's comparable. So I guess my point is, it's not that this never happens, but that it's highly improbable given the personalities.
So let's assume there were skilled diplomats. What's real in this situation, knowing what you do from afar about Kim Jong-un and about this president of the United States? What can the United States offer? I assume, obviously, one of the things is he would like the lifting of economic sanctions, meaning Kim Jong-un. Can we expect, quote, denuclearization, end quote? What more do they want from us? What's the trade?
It's sort of analogous to the Iran deal, where they put their nuclear program on ice in exchange for some kind of enforceable security guarantees and a lifting of sanctions. And the other tricky thing is that the West, the United States in particular, has viewed North Korea as a pariah regime. North Korea would like to have trade with South Korea. And for the first time, you've got a relative softliner in charge in South Korea. Now, if that's part of the deal, how's the United States going to look on that? Because South Korea is one of our most loyal military allies. And another question is, what kind of a role is China going to play? China's not in favor of a drastic change in the status quo.
They are encouraging these talks, from what I understood this morning.
Well, but you have no idea what kind of a game they're really playing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they may be encouraging these talks on the premise that the talks are very likely to fail, and then Trump is even more dependent on Beijing to, quote, restrain the North Koreans. So this is multi-level chess.
We're talking to Bob Kuttner, who's the co-editor of The American Prospect. His new book coming out in April is Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism?
So I get why China doesn't want a change in the status quo, but you mentioned how would we look if South and North Korea were to trade? How would we look? I mean, what does that mean for us?
I think, depending on who you talk to, the American foreign policy establishment is very ambivalent about this. You know, on the one hand, there's a long-shot possibility of damping down regional tensions. On the other hand, given that North Korea has been such a loyal ally, and North Korea has been a pariah, we're not really entirely comfortable with North Korea and South Korea cozying up. But, you know, it's their peninsula, it's their culture, it's their language. And it's kind of surprising that this hasn't happened sooner.
And the upside of cozying up for South Korea is what?
Well, my God, I mean, they are, you know, downtown Seoul is, what, 60 miles away.
Issue. Okay.
And they would be obliterated with conventional
weapons. Right, but the trade thing obviously would be good for them, South Korea.
Yeah, but I think the security thing would be even more important.
Okay.
If they can ratchet back the kind of mutual armed camp and the threat that this modern, very prosperous city of Seoul could be obliterated in the first 15 minutes, that's a huge goal for them.
Okay. I pardon me, because I am not, you know, you are the scholar on this and I am not. So, and how does that hurt the United States of America? That's what I don't get. If I know that they're a pariah country and all that kind of stuff, but if the South and North were trading, the military threat were lessened, isn't that good for everybody?
Yes, it is. But the conventional wisdom has been South Korea is our docile, faithful ally. When I say we, you know, you have to unpack who that we is. A lot of hardline diplomats are not sure they're comfortable with South Korea negotiating its own detente with North Korea, plus the fact that we're used to calling the shots.
Okay.
And if God forbid, the South Koreans and the North Koreans are talking to each other without asking us first, that makes a lot of American diplomats who are used to controlling the whole show uneasy.
You know, even people who are Trump critics, I'm thinking, I saw Bill Richardson last night, who can't stand him, former governor, former ambassador, praising him for bringing bringing Kim Jong-un to the table, whether it's because of threats or the economic sanctions or whatever it is. Do you not worry? I know you worry. When these two guys are actually sitting at the table, in light of the fact that no rules apply to Donald Trump and detail is surely not his strong suit, do you worry about what actually happens when they're sitting there?
Yes, of course, because Trump, who, you know, can't read anything longer than a paragraph, and there's a whole history here.
That's not a criticism for those. That is a fact. No, they give him his morning briefings orally.
That's correct. And this stuff is actually, you know, he said, who knew trade's complicated? Well, nuclear diplomacy is also complicated. And given the fact that his entire modus operandi is to just do stuff off the top of his head, you know, you can't make up what he might do. You know, he might trade nuclear disarmament for Worcester. I mean, who knows?
You know, maybe they can bond. We're all hearing about Trump and these multiple porn actresses. Perhaps there's a bonding opportunity there. Maybe Kim Jong-un is into that sort of thing as well. They can bond over women.
We only have a minute, but can I just say the thing that worries me, and I have the same level of expertise Marjorie does in these areas,
which is none.
I agree, and that's not a criticism of her, but it's honest. No, exactly. But it's so clear to me from afar that the lack of strategic thinking on the part of our president is matched by huge strategic thinking on the part of Kim Jong-un. You can see how he decided, I'll build up my nuclear capacity.
Oh, yeah.
I'll test these missiles. I'll say I can reach Chicago, at which point there'll be negotiations or at least talks. And at the end, I am accepted into the international community.
Absolutely.
With these, I mean, okay, so we're in the same
place. He's crazy like a fox, and Trump is crazy.
We're going to take a break here. We're talking to Robert Kuttner. He's co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. When we come back, we're going to talk to him about tariffs. That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
This is Boston Public Radio on WGBH. Made possible thanks to listener contributions. Your support of just $5 or $10 a month keeps Jim and Marjorie and the great conversations coming your way. Please take a moment to give now at WGBHnews.org or call 888-897-9424.
You ask, we provide. There was a stampede to get hold of the last smug mug when people got a look at the picture of Jim looking as smug and slippery and shifty as he possibly could.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
But he's outdone himself in the smug mug part two, where he looks even more slippery, suspicious, shifty, and smug. And it is only available today, a one deal day. It is today. $12.50 a month. We will thank you with the new Boston Public Radio smug mug part two, brand new, only available until 2 o'clock today. And by the way, in terms of budget planning at WGBH, you always try to push the sustainer membership, because if you give $12.50 a month, we know what's coming for the next month, and that makes a big difference. So I tell you, it's not to be believed. I'm looking at the picture right now.
Go ahead.
And you've taken smug into the stratosphere.
I have.
That's
I've
all
elevated
I can say.
To an art form. I have.
He's looking down at us all. And that's kind of what he does.
The number
is 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
By the way, you can become a member for as little as $5 a month. But as Marjorie says, for an extra $7.50 a month, you can own this smug mug. It's actually, I was going to say, it's quite good looking. It's got nice heft. It's a nice color. It's got nice color. And it has an incredibly beautiful photograph of Marjorie on one side, under which it says live, local, and highly caffeinated. And it has an appalling photograph of me on the other side, and it's $12.50 a month. And by the way, this really matters to us beyond Marjorie's obsession with the mug, and apparently a lot of our listeners' obsession too. There's this misconception that a huge part of our funding comes from government sources. It's not true. It's an infinitesimally small percentage. We depend upon you to be here and do what we do, and it means a lot to us. So both financially and emotionally, it's a huge lift for us when you're kind enough to go to the phone at 888-897-9424 or go online at WGBHnews.org and say you support the work that we and all of our colleagues do. Go ahead, talk about the smug mug.
We can't thank all the people that have called in to get the smug mug, but we want to single out a few. John in Sharon, Sally in Rye, New Hampshire, Jane in Weston, Stephen in Sturbridge, Joseph in Dighton. I want to repeat again, the smug mug is available today, and it is gone at 2 o'clock, and that's it. No more smug mugs until smug mug 3 and 4 comes apart, but I mean, comes
They'll
available.
Keep coming.
But you never know when that could be. So take advantage of it. Every monthly gift, as Jim says, makes a big difference keeping us on the air. Well, you know, if you can only give a little bit, that's great. If you can give a lot, that would be awesome. But if you can give $12.50 per month, that's like the cost of a pizza, maybe even less. You too can have this incredible smug mug when Jim is looking as impossibly smug.
Let's move on. Thank you, Marjorie.
As anybody could possibly believe. The Smug Mug, only till 2 o'clock today, $12.50 a month. 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brown. She's Marjorie Egan. We are broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Yesterday, Donald Trump, despite widespread condemnation from his own party, actually, imposed tariffs on imported steel and aluminum in an effort to stop unfair foreign trade practices, which have forced plants and mills across the U.S., he suggests, to shut down.
The American steel aluminum industry has been ravaged by aggressive foreign trade practices. It's really an assault on our country. Other countries have added production capacity that far exceeds demand. For example, it takes China about 1 month to produce as much steel as they produce in the United States in an entire year because we've closed down so much capacity. Plants closed all over the United States. Well, we're going to get those buildings open again and producing again. And that's going to be a great thing for our country.
Bob Kuttner, in a recent piece for the American Prospect entitled Trump, the Bull in the China (parentheses) Policy Shop, outlines how years of avoiding China have driven ultra-nationalists like Donald Trump to take a leadership role in trade. Bob is the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect. His forthcoming book in early April is Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism?
Okay, Robert Kuttner, people have been all over the place on this as well. Some critics are saying this is like the Rat Pack president coming out again, where he's looking back to, you know, Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra and a backward view of America. Other people have said that this is high time. You characterized it in your piece, I love this, a, quote, dumb variant of a long overdue policy, unquote. So elaborate on that.
Well, even though Trump mentioned China in passing, China is really the missing part of this story. We do need a very serious set of sanctions and an aggressive policy against Chinese state capitalism. What Trump did, because it's simpler and easier for him to grasp, is he levied tariffs on everybody. Now, if you look at the numbers, and I don't want to get too wonky here, but it's very important. We produce about 70 million metric tons of steel. China produces 800 million. And the world overcapacity is almost as much as China produces. And what China does is the government of China subsidizes production, and that drives down world prices. And that means that companies that don't have subsidized production can't make a living and they go out of business. And it's not just steel and aluminum. It's the whole Chinese system of state capitalism. So look at what's happened in the past 10 days. Xi has declared that he's going to be, in effect, president for life. And instead of recognizing the strategic threat, Trump says, hey, we might try that. You know, he has dictator envy. And the other thing that happened is that a little-known group called CFIUS, which is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., took an unusually aggressive stance. They've been very docile, but a front for the government of China tried to do a hostile takeover to buy Qualcomm, which is one of our high-tech crown jewels. And CFIUS, which is part of the government, said, wait a minute, not so fast. We're going to block this. So it's rather like climate change. It's coming at us much more abruptly than we thought, and the it is China taking over the world economy through state-led mercantilism, if you will. Now, the other thing is these tariffs did not come out of nowhere. Several months ago, Trump, using a section of the trade law that allows for retaliation based on national security concerns, Section 232, ordered the Commerce Department to do a comprehensive review of China's practices. And they found that state-subsidized aluminum and steel were doing dire damage to America's ability to even have a steel industry and an aluminum industry, and that the primary culprit was China. So about a month ago, the Commerce Department tenders its report, doesn't get much publicity, and the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, does this lengthy decision memo saying, well, you know, you could target China or you could target six other countries, and that's what we're recommending. But Trump, going for the simple-minded, bold stroke, says, I'm going to raise tariffs on everybody. At that point, the free trade establishment, which has been completely oblivious to what China is up to, which doesn't understand that if the other guy is practicing protectionism, you are not a protectionist if you challenge his policies, the free trade establishment goes nuts. So what Trump did by taking a step in the direction of the right policy, but in the worst possible way, is he just stokes up the deniers.
So, and by the way, the one, not correction, but addendum, is when you said it applies to everybody, theoretically, our NAFTA partners, for lack of a better noun,
yeah, at the last
Mexico
minute.
And Canada are going to be exempted if he's happy with the NAFTA renegotiation, if there is one. So if the goal was good, but the vehicle to get there was the wrong one, what should he have done if he was concerned, as you are, about the impact of China?
Well, I think that China policy should be something like all of the rest of the world, certainly the EU, European Union, and the United States, saying to the Chinese, we are not going to tolerate state-subsidized capitalism in a dictatorship driving out industry after industry after industry in the West, which more or less plays by free market rules. So
how do we not tolerate it? How do we do that?
Then you have targeted tariffs and quotas and other kinds of restrictions to compensate for the degree of subsidy that China gives its state-owned industries. And you interfere with the ability of China to coerce partnerships with Western countries, where the deal is, you know, if Boeing or GE wants to manufacture in China, the deal is it has to transfer technology, it has to transfer trade secrets. And the Chinese have also used state intelligence to steal commercial mm-hmm. secrets. So they don't play by the same rules that we do. Now, I can literally count on the fingers of one hand, because I've interviewed all of them, the China experts who've been, you know, offstage warning about this for 20 years. And why aren't they taken seriously? Well, they're not taken seriously because the financial industry makes a ton of money by doing deals with China. And some of the American corporations for whom the United States government is not going to bat have, in effect, made a separate peace with China. So Intel will say, well, okay, if you're going to build me a billion-dollar factory and I get cheap Chinese labor and maybe I have to transfer more technology than I want to, and maybe I can't play according to genuine free market rules, but I'll take the deal. And that's what happened. One corporation after another has decided to take the deal because there's been no strategic counteroffensive on the part of the West.
You know, is it fair to say that your new friend, I don't know if he's still your friend, but the friend whose job you cost, Steve Bannon, wasn't China
yes.
policy one of the reasons this guy could, and by the way, for those who don't remember,
yeah, say that, tell him.
Bob got a call on the phone from a guy you had not met before, right?
Right.
Bannon, you then did an interview that ended up being the end of Bannon's career, not just career at the White House, maybe career, as
right.
it turns out.
Right.
Where would, what would he be saying? Is he, have you spoken to him since his demise?
A couple of times.
You have?
Yeah, oh, sure. See, you have to understand, Bannon is such a narcissist. Bannon thinks there's going to be some grand left-right coalition. So about 2 weeks after I got him fired, I called him, and I said, looks like I did you a favor, because that was the moment when he was sort of back in the limelight as the organizer of the far right, and that he was going to run candidates
yeah,
against
the Roy
everybody.
Moore campaign.
Yeah.
His finest hour, I thought.
Yeah. And he said, oh, yeah, Bob, I'm doing great, Bob. You know, come on over to the townhouse. And it was insane, just completely insane. And so I went over to the townhouse, and we talked. And but what's interesting is Bannon's view of China is just about identical. I mean, stripping out the hyperbole. The trade hawks who have gotten control of trade policy, who include some rather serious people. I mean, Robert Lighthizer, who's the chief trade negotiator, was Reagan's chief trade negotiator. Then he became a trade lawyer. He is a very serious guy. He's not a wacko. And Reagan, because of Reagan's concern with national security, is the only recent president who's taken the threat of Asian mercantilism against American industry seriously. So Lighthizer was Reagan's top guy. And Navarro is even more intemperate, but he's a PhD economist from the University of California who happens to be something of a, I won't say protectionist, but an economic nationalist. And the third guy in the triumvirate, Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, you know, used to be a private equity guy who did a ton with the steel industry. So these are not stupid people. But what's interesting is they put in front of Trump an array of serious policy alternatives. And Trump, being Trump, didn't read the memo and said, I will pick the craziest, most inflammatory one. And, you know, there's a special election for a congressional seat outside of Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Tuesday.
And if the Republican pulls it out, it's very close, I suspect it'll be because of this tariff order.
Barbara Cotton, we're almost out of time here. So what's this going to mean for all of us consumers? You know, you've been reading that our cars are going to get more expensive, our washing machines are going to be paying through the nose for this.
Not a damn thing.
Okay, not a damn thing. That's
because,
good to know.
Because the people who are going nuts about this have completely forgotten how this really works, and there's a 40-year history where you announce an increase in tariffs, and the other side pushes back, and then there's a negotiation. I mean, the stock market, actually, which, you know, often doesn't know a damn thing, stock market's up. And the stock market, I think, correctly surmises that this is just the beginning of a protracted process that opens the door to some negotiations. The fact that at the 11th hour, he exempts Mexico and Canada, and is probably going to exempt Australia.
Which, by the way, that Peter Navarro guy did not even know, because when he spoke yesterday morning, said they were included. But go ahead, finish up. I'm sorry.
So the point is, I don't have a crystal ball, but I can tell you with a fair degree of confidence that over the next 3 or 4 months, this is going to be changed 16 different times. And maybe they'll even find their way to targeting China.
Okay.
Bob,
so
it's great to see you.
I'm glad about the washing machines and the new car, because I may need one.
Because that's all we really care about,
that's
right, Marjorie?
Well, I mean, if the steel guys can make more money, too, I mean, that's great, too, right? They could use it, I'm sure. Anyway, Robert Kuttner is co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He's also the Meyer and Ida Kirsten Chair at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis. His forthcoming book, out next month, Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? Robert Kuttner, thank you very much for being with us.
See you, Bob.
Up next, today marks the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. What am I talking about? The famed fearless girl statue holding her own in a very male-dominated turf war. Shirley Leung joins us for that and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. One programming note. We have both been saying for the last week or so that we will now be here, at least for the next couple of months. We're trying it out every single Wednesday, with one exception.
Yep.
Next Wednesday, we will not be
no,
here.
No, we will not.
There'll be another program here, another thing here. We'll be here
Thursday
of next week.
That's right.
And then we'll return to Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday the following week. It's been a year since the women of Wall Street took on the wolves of Wall Street by way of the fearless girl. The now famous statue has held her own and in many ways symbolically won a turf war in this era of Me Too. Joining us to talk about this and other headlines is Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung. Hello there, Shirley. She's
Hi.
Also a GBH contributor. Hi, Shirley.
Shirley, we're going to get back to the fearless girl in just a second, but You have been a relentless crusader for women in high places around Boston and Massachusetts, and I think you may have just sunk the chances of Steve Crosby, whom I like very much, who's in here all the time. He's the head of the Gaming Commission, but I guess he's put his hat in the ring for UMass Boston, and your reaction is what? Another white guy?
Another white male insider. You know, I've been working on a piece about the search for UMass Boston, the head of UMass Boston. That's really the next big state public education job to fill.
Yep.
The last two, Salem State University presidency, as well as the K-12 commissioner, went to, after a global national search, the local white male insider. And so here, Crosby, on Thursday, yesterday, he came out as the only name, you know, publicly named candidate for UMass Boston chancellorship. And I worried. I mean, I think Crosby's very smart, very capable. He was a UMass Boston dean.
Dean of the McCormick School, right?
Right, I think he was the founding dean.
I think he may have been, yeah.
Before coming to become the chairman of the State Gaming Commission, he was the secretary, A&F secretary, so completely capable.
He was Jane Swift's chief of staff,
yes,
too. Yes,
very, yeah. Very capable. But I wonder, can we do better? Can we think bigger? And I worry that when you have a candidate like him out there, out front, it scares away the rest of the field, thinking that this guy's got the inside track. Why should I bother? Because in Massachusetts, it's a public process. So if you, when you apply and you become a finalist, your name is out there. As a final, you get outed as a finalist.
I know.
And so if you don't get the job, then...
I know you need to do that, but I often think it... scares away a lot of people that don't want their present boss to know,
right,
they're looking for work elsewhere.
Well, I talked to Paul Revel about
this. You see this with superintendents all
right,
the time.
Right, Paul Revel, who's a regular guest on this show.
Former Secretary of Education.
Yeah, very smart guy.
He said this is the reason why we don't get the very best candidates.
I think that's
true.
Because
it's a very public process.
Oh, by the way, and the reason for the very public process is what exactly?
I think it's our open meeting laws in part, and so it requires...
Everybody abuses them, open meeting laws all the time.
Oh, that's great, Marjorie. That's a great
people
response.
People do.
Just violate the
no,
law.
No,
so
I'm just saying that's a fact of life. I mean, you have to at some point say to yourself, okay, we don't want everyone hiring their brother-in-law, being surreptitious about it,
right.
But when you can't, you know, with all due respect to the superintendent searches for the Boston Public Schools, every time we have a superintendent search, it's talking about there's not, where are the big guns?
Yeah.
And they're not there because they don't want...
There were big guns for this public education job that Riley ended up getting. The two other women were, one of the women was wildly qualified.
But you have no idea if you would have gotten even a
bigger,
more impressive group of people.
Public money, Marjorie.
It's public money, but I think there's got to be a way to sort of finesse this a little bit.
Right.
Or just wait until further on in the process or something. I'm sorry, I've interrupted you.
So UMass Boston, you know, they're going to begin, you know, they've gotten a bunch of applications looking at the field, and end of March they're going to start bringing people for interviews.
You know, Shirley Leung and I have been fighting about quotas for all the time I've known you. The other night I had the outgoing president of Bentley, Gloria Larson, on my show. We were talking about the issue that you write about all the time, the dearth of women and people of color in high places, in public education in particular. And you know what she said to me? She said, and I assumed it was just a clever aside, well, the next three positions should go to women.
We talked about this last week.
I know that. I'm saying it's relevant here.
Right.
And I said, it's a quota. And she said, fine. The quota has been in the other direction, all guys, forever. And but the whole, it's really hard because to me, I'm an admirer of Crosby's in a lot of ways. He's one of the few public figures who, even in tough times, always comes here and answers questions.
Yes.
I think most people think he's done quite a competent job at the Gaming Commission, but I think the issues about diversity, and I assume he'd agree too, are really important when they, as you've written about, used to be 5 out of 9 state universities run by women a decade ago. Now it's 0 out of 9.
Right.
So I'm with you.
And so I think in this situation, also I should point out UMass Boston is a majority-minority campus.
Right.
Minority campus.
Yeah.
And so you would want a person of color, you know, in the leadership role. But I think but there are a lot of issues. There are a lot of problems at UMass Boston. They're in financial straits.
They are.
They've got big infrastructure improvements
to
manage
everywhere.
Right. And they also, and it's a school at a crossroads. You know, they're just adding dorms in the fall. They're very much like where Northeastern was in the 1990s. You know, moving from a commuter school to a destination campus. So there are a lot of things to do with this school.
You know, I was thinking about your piece about this morning, this piece about UMass, And I think there's an analogy to a very high-profile congressional race in Boston. No, I'm serious
yeah,
about
no,
this.
Yeah, no, there is.
Mike
yes.
Capuano, yes. I think he's been there 10 years or maybe even, was it 10 terms? I can't remember. Could someone check that out so I get it right, please, and let me know? Is running for re-election.
Yeah.
Is generally seen as a solid progressive. And he's being challenged by another progressive, Ayanna Pressley. When Ayanna Pressley was asked by the city councilor, when she was asked by the Globe, what are your policy differences, she was not able to articulate right. any. And there are a lot of women. Martha Coakley told me, the former attorney general, that she is, the other night off air, that she is the co-sponsor of a fundraiser. It was supposed to happen the other night
for
Ayanna Pressley. Well. And I've heard from a lot of women in particular who echo pretty much what you said. They have no criticism of Michael Capuano, yeah. but their view is, well, it's almost like a time's up kind of thing. So is that a fair analogy? Or
it,
no?
It is, absolutely. I mean, when I think about, I think when Ayanna threw her hat into the ring, I was like, oh, this is going to be tough. I don't think she can unseat Capuano. And then what happened this week, my colleague Josh Miller wrote a story. He started polling other fellow members of from the congressional delegation to see who's backing Capuano, who's backing Pressley. And remarkably, a number of them are staying neutral.
Both of our senators, Nikki Tsongas and
about,
Seth Moulton, sitting it out.
Talk about white men. I mean, we have, Catherine Clark, and who else is the woman that's in our congressional?
Nikki Tsongas.
Well, she's gone now.
Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I know, but I'm thinking of the Congress people. Uh-huh. That there's one woman, right? With Nikki Tsongas being gone, I think so.
I think that's right.
And we have no person of color.
Right, and so I actually, she's jumping in, and, she's, I assume she's money from Barbara Lee, right? Barbara
yeah,
Lee.
Yeah, she's a co-sponsor of that event, too.
And what she's doing and what Maura Healey did, too, is like they weren't going to wait their turn. They're like, we're going to run now. Now's the time. Why should we wait our turn? I mean, Maura Healey ran against Warren Tolman.
Warren Tolman.
There's a big difference. That was an open seat.
Well, something
that's
else?
True. That's
I
true.
Think the thing with Ayanna Pressley that she is. Maura Healey was one of the best natural campaigners I've seen in a long time, and she came shot out of nowhere. She was really, really good. So that's going to be a tough act to follow for Ayanna Pressley. I'm not sure if she's...
She's very charismatic, Ayanna.
Yeah.
And what I think of, I'm a business columnist, and I think about why does Ayanna have a real shot here? And it's not that that she's going to change Capuano supporters or something to wake up. It's like, I'm going to vote for Ayanna. There'll be a group of them, but not a lot. She's going to grow the market of voters. There are going to be more women coming out, more people of color, seeing someone like them. Them running for office. So,
yep.
I mean, that's really the hope for Ayanna, that she'll bring out all these new voters, and that's the way that she could beat Capuano.
We should say, in light of the fact that a primary difference is gender and race, is the highest profile civil rights leader in Congress, John Lewis, has endorsed Mike Capuano, saying he's a great leader on civil rights issues. Yeah. So it's going to be a nationally watched
race.
No,
it is. It is a national. I think the Times wrote about the race too. And it will be a very great race to watch and cover.
So Shirley Leung, let's move on to the anniversary of the Fearless Girl. There was a lot of dispute when the Fearless Girl first showed up face to face with the Wall Street bull, whatever it is,
charging bull in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah, but the Fearless Girl is still there.
Yes.
So what happened with that fighting and complaining about how she was usurping the artistic space of the bull sculptor?
Well, she's still there. She's been on a temporary permit. The New York City is supposed to decide any day now her fate, whether she will be allowed to stay there or she has to find a new location. The local press in New York have been reporting that it could be that the mayor de Blasio likes the statue. I mean, he said publicly he likes the statue. I think there's efforts to make it permanent. But it might not be in that spot, though.
Oh.
They actually might move both the bull and the girl because it causes too much traffic. They may move both of them to more pedestrian.
What do you think?
But in tandem, you think?
Yeah, it has to be.
Oh, that'd be
great.
It has to be.
I'm with you.
Okay. She doesn't work without the bull.
Okay, so you're in favor of their being face-to-face.
Right, so they
have
to be moved. No, the talk is... of them moving together.
Okay.
And one of the things that happens, so one of the reasons we also talk about Fearless Girl here in Boston is because it the investment arm of State Street, which is a local Boston financial institution, is behind this piece of guerrilla art. And on the one-year anniversary, they released some new statistics on her impact.
Can you share a few? They were amazing,
yeah.
Actually.
So the Fearless Girl really symbolizes State Street's stance on basically a stance against all-male corporate boards. And so State Street invests a lot of money in companies and in public companies, and they said if you have an all-male board, I mean, they sent notices to 787 companies in the U.S., United Kingdom, Australia with all-male boards and said you need to put more women on your board. You need to get your act together.
All companies in which they had investments.
Exactly.
Okay.
So about over 500 companies, they end up voting against them because they didn't do anything. And this is where it's the amazing part. 152 companies with all-male boards actually put at least one woman on their board. Another 34 will put a woman on their board in the near term.
Really?
Yeah, and so it caused change, and then but State Street isn't just stopping there. This week they announced that their new campaign is to start screening their portfolio companies for looking at how they put women in management, women at all levels of management, and so they want to make sure that companies have are advancing women into more senior roles. And the reason why this is important because it builds the pipeline.
Yes.
Of future female directors. Often, you don't get to serve on a board unless you are a top executive, a CEO or a CFO. You have occupied a senior level position in a big company.
We're talking to Shirley Lund. So, Shirley, your columns generally provoke a decent amount of discussion in the city. That's an understatement. They provoke a lot of discussion. And it's generally in the world at large. A recent column of yours generated a lot of discussion, but particularly in this community, meaning the media community.
Yes.
The headline of the piece that you and Laura Kranz wrote was, "We tried to ask Charlie Baker a question. Here's what happened." Why don't you tell people, if they didn't read it, what happened?
So this was a reporter's notebook.
I read that,
yes. Not a true column from me. But yeah. So it was Laura Kranz covers higher education for the Boston Globe. And we were both at an event Monday night at the UMass Club. And Marty Meehan, the president of UMass, was giving a speech at the State of UMass. And the governor was in attendance. He was sitting in the front row. He was acknowledged. And Laura, and the subject of his speech was the affordability of public higher education.
Of Meehan's speech.
Meehan's speech,
okay.
Right. And so Laura said, "I'm going to go ask the governor to get reaction. I'm going to ask him that question. You know, what does he think about the affordability of public higher education in Massachusetts?" And I was there actually reporting my UMass Boston story. I wasn't there to cover the governor or anything. And so I said, is it on his public event schedule? She's like, "No. Is there going to be a media avail afterwards? Because the rules are, you can only go talk to the governor if he's available. You know, if his schedule said there's a media avail." And she said, "No, but he's just right there. I'm just going to go up." And so I said, "Okay, I'll help you." So we both made we both made a beeline to the governor, and knowing that it would be difficult because his press aide had said he's running behind. He won't have time for any questions. Just send us an email. And Laura's like, "He's just right there. I'm just going to ask him a question." So we're standing inches away from him. And I decided, well, you go to the left, I go to the right. And I'll block him so he can't, he can't escape. And but the governor was very focused on shaking hands. I mean, he didn't look like he was in a hurry. And so, but we never got to ask our question. And so we ended up writing a piece about, why wasn't this fair game? Why couldn't we ask the governor a question about that was on point? Why couldn't we ask the governor a question about higher education at a higher education event?
What kind of feedback have you gotten on this?
Some people loved it. Some people hated it. Some people were confused by it. It's actually been really fascinating. I mean, this was an unusual story. We usually don't, talk about our relationship with the governor or how we cover the governor. And Laura wanted to write it because she was mad. She was like, this is ridiculous. I should have been able to, I shouldn't have been banned from asking a question. And,
can I interrupt you at that point? One of the things I didn't understand when I read the story,
right.
If you're inches away, why didn't she just ask the question?
Right. So we were in a situation, so other people asked, why didn't you shout a question in it? Because it would
have... Well, if you're inches, you don't have to shout it. Why
well,
don't you...
because well, we would have to interrupt a conversation he was having with someone after being told, do not talk to the governor. So we were trying to be respectful. So, you know, so we did talk about, but we were like, it wasn't a situation. And my colleagues and I talked about this, like, what are the situations where you would start shouting questions at a public official, right? At an event like this, it would be like it would be for like an indictment or something like that, or something some big controversial. It wouldn't be like, what do you think about the cost of public higher education, right?
Yes, but, are you guilty?
Are you guilty?
Did you do it?
Right. But one of the things I also wanted to mention, one of the reasons why I got involved in the story was because I wanted to challenge the status quo of how the State House Press Corps covers the governor.
Meaning what?
I mean, there are all these rules. You know, I was there last month for Story, and I came back, it's like all flustered. It's like, what is this? It's very male-centric, it's very male-dominated. You have a few minutes, everybody's standing in the front, you have to shout over each other to get your questions, you have a fight. And it was actually a very offensive way for me. I was like, is this how we're supposed to cover the governor?
When you say male-centric, do you mean the government end of it, or your fellow?
No, my fellow State House Press Corps.
Pushing and shoving.
Because a lot of them were critical of you. I've spoken, you well know, saying sort of the arrogant Globe, what are they entitled?
And why do you think they're critical?
I don't know. Why
are
they critical?
Well, because if they sided with us, what do you think the governor's team will do? They might not get called on at the next State House press conference. The governor might not acknowledge them. So they might get blackballed. And so I think Joan Vernocchi, another columnist who at the Globe who does not cover the State House, she was tweeting, I don't understand why there's not solidarity among the press corps backing Laura and Shirley. You know, shouldn't we all push for more access to the governor?
But is he generally saying, I mean, obviously, the only two people who are in no position to have an opinion is me and Marjorie, yeah, in light of the fact that he is kind enough to come to us.
Right.
Once
he's kind
a
enough
month.
To come. But
what
you
is
know,
the
I've
perception?
Been in positions what's like the that many times.
What's the perception of Baker in terms of as an accessible or inaccessible official?
And we looked into that. And so he does have a media avail. He is accessible. He's not as bad as Mitt Romney, who actually would set up velvet ropes to keep the
that was the first velvet rope at the state. And I'm serious. Wasn't it the first velvet rope as Romney?
And so, but I guess in this particular incident, we were at a public event. He was recognized, and the question was about higher education.
You know, he said, I don't know what outlet he said it to. You know, he said he didn't hear you. You know
he
that.
Didn't see us.
See us, I'm
and,
sorry.
And I did, you. I said, he is really tall, but we were standing, I was trying to get eye contact with him. I was hovering around him, trying to get eye contact. Meanwhile, the press aide was in between us, saying, like, he doesn't have time to talk,
Didn't one of the press aides, didn't I read in your story, one of the press aides asked Laura if she wanted to take a picture?
They thought we wanted a selfie with the governor, and so they didn't recognize us as press people. But it was meant to kind of... I also want to say, this was not meant to be a gotcha. This was meant to be a slice of Beacon Hill life and cover of politics in the press. And it wasn't meant to be to say the governor, never talks to the media. But I think in this...
He's never talking to you now again, that's for sure.
Well, I also have to say that...
That was a joke, everybody.
I was trying to think, coming in here, I was thinking, you guys have the governor on for an hour.
We do.
You get to, in a very civil manner, you get to go back and forth and ask him follow-up questions, right?
Right.
If I had to recreate that, right? Like, I would probably have spent 2 months going to press conferences to get amount.
We're lucky, right?
And so I'm just saying that I'm raising the question: is that the status quo? Is that how it should work? You know, to have that. I mean, he is tightly controlled.
Well, let me just say one thing about this: the beauty of having a public official come in, and I've mentioned this to every public official who's been kind enough to do this with us for the last 20 years. We get emails all the time from people saying, I don't support Charlie Baker, I don't support Marty Walsh, I don't this, but the fact that he or she, Maura Healey, has the decency to come in and take calls from all comers. And I'll tell you one other thing about Baker, which is not the case with every single public official, without naming names, he doesn't pick the calls. We've asked him if he wants to pick the calls, and he has said, no, I don't. You just take any call in any order, meaning it's our choice, not
but
his.
It's a much different, in fairness to those scrum situations, yeah, which we've all been in as reporters, it's a much different thing because you are, it's three-way and he's here for an hour. You're not going to go after someone in that way that you would at a statehouse thing where you're screaming at people if it's some dire thing that they've done. You know, it's a different. It's
but you
a
can ask
kind of
a lot of. You can ask as many questions to your heart content, and I don't get that. As
that's
a
correct.
Reporter.
That's correct.
And so that's why I wrote that story. It's like,
right,
I don't understand why certain people get certain access, and other people like Laura Krantz and I have to.
Wait a second. Wait.
Down
with the exception of Marjorie and me, yeah, and it's a different thing. It's not just us. It's the public having access. Take us out of the mix, right, for a second. Does anybody is anybody treated better or worse? I mean, I would argue the Globe gets a pretty good deal from most public officials because it's the paper of record here.
Right. And so I don't know how Charlie Baker's relationship with the Globe ranks with other public officials.
I don't know.
I mean, again, this was not meant to be a gotcha. This was meant to be to kind of provide a window into how the governor is covered.
I hear rumors because Emily's off tonight. Adam's hosting. I hear this is a topic on Beat the Press.
Oh, it's not. It's true. I can confirm it. I did a taping with Adam Riley yesterday at
good.
The Globe. So yeah.
Miss it.
Oh,
we'll be
I
watching.
I love watching Beat the Press almost as much as I love watching.
Can I tell you, we didn't get to the whole Union Square thing. I want to discuss that next week.
Next
it
week.
Matters a lot to me.
Right. Shirley Young joins us every week. She's a business columnist for the Boston Globe and a WGBH contributor. Shirley, thank you very much. Up next, Michelle Obama, former First Lady turned Queen. Callie Crossy joins us to explain that. She is next. I'm going to talk to you about a bunch of stuff on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
All I can say is oi. This is Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. I know Marjorie's going to ask her what she thinks of the picture. Joining us, so let's get it out of the way, as she does every Friday, is the host, I'm not done yet, is host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. That, of course, is Callie Crossley. Go ahead, Marjorie. You can't control yourself. Go ahead.
What do you think?
It's different.
Thank you.
Somebody here's out to get him. What did you say?
I don't know who took the photo, so I'm just gonna leave
how
that alone.
How great is Marjorie looking?
She
her picture.
Really good.
I have all my makeup
God.
On that day.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to thank Phoebe, of course. She did a beautiful job making me up that day, as she always does. That really matters. So, Callie Crossy, we almost never have any breaking news here.
Yes.
Well, actually, I won't go to that first because the bigger story is this really cute and adorable story about this little two-year-old girl seeing the portrait of Michelle Obama and thinking Michelle Obama was a queen. And then you have a picture of Michelle Obama and this two-year-old kid dancing. This is the portrait that came out of her in the white, what do you call that kind of dress? The evening gown, ball gown, what do you call it?
National Portrait Gallery.
National Portrait Gallery, yeah. Did you like that portrait? I wasn't keen on it.
I liked it, but I'm just so struck that in her remarks on the day that they unveiled it, she said, "I hope some young girl comes to see the photo and sees herself and all of that." And oh my goodness, she could not have imagined this cute little 2-year-old who was just staring at the photo, and her mother kept trying to get her to turn around so she could take a picture of her while she was with the portrait in the background, and she would not turn around. She was totally mesmerized. 2-year-old Parker Curry.
Parker Curry. We actually have sound of Parker Curry. As we said, she was staring up at the portrait of Michelle Obama in the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery. The picture went viral, and Don Lemon interviewed Parker and her mother, Jessica.
Did you like to meet Michelle Obama?
Yes,
we had a really great time. Michelle Obama. She's really down to earth, really sweet. We had a good time talking to her. Her and Parker chatted, and they hung out, and Parker got her out of her shoes and got her up and dancing. And it was just like a really surreal moment.
Yeah, you couldn't hear what the little girl was saying, Clay. What she says, Michelle.
Oh, yes. I know.
Oh my God, is that sweet?
And Don Lemon kept asking her, "Well, you know, she's the First Lady. What do you think about a First Lady?" She says, "No, she's a queen," because that's what she thought she was the first time that she saw her. So several things about it. Just the story itself is so heartwarming and wonderful. I love the fact that her mother said, "I hope other mothers will take their kids to museums in general."
Yeah,
but certainly to go see this. And she's wearing Afro puffs, which my niece used to wear when she was little. And we loved them on her until she just refused to wear them because she said the kids made fun of her and said they look like broccoli. Oh. So it's like a whole, it was a whole self-esteem thing. But this little girl feels pretty good about herself, and yeah. I loved it. And I just think it's just the sweetest story about what you never know what can get kids involved and connected. And there she was, two. Who would have thought?
Two. You know, it was the photograph is really touching, and I would bet that most people who saw it thought of another photograph that was equally as touching. Do you remember that little African-American kid in the Oval Office with Barack
Obama? Yes, yes. I have a copy of that,
when the president allowed him to touch his... Yes. His hair.
Right.
Oh, my God.
He bent over so that the little boy could see that his hair was just the same.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's really cute. One of the news photographers, who's a member of the National Association of Black Journalists, offered that up for auction to raise money for
Yes,
and several of us have copies of that. It's very adorable.
It's a beautiful picture. We're talking to Callie Crossley, and we're at the Boston Public Library.
Mm. So we saw her at the Academy Awards, Tiffany Haddish. She was up there on the stage with Maya Rudolph. Great little story about her frugality. And you don't usually think of a $4,000 dress as frugal, but why do we think it's frugal?
Because Tiffany Haddish, when she did Saturday Night Live, was clear with everybody. You see this dress? I paid a lot of money for it, and I'm going to wear it a lot. Because I don't have $4,000 to throw away on a one-time wear. And she says, I don't care what people say about it. I'm wearing it over and over again. This is part of who she is. This is why she got the Groupon gig, you know.
Tell us her story. She's got a great story.
So she's on Jimmy Kimmel right after doing Girls Trip. This is one of the breakout stars of the Girls Trip movie. And she's explaining to him that they had taken her to a lovely dinner, and it was, you know, very fancy. And in return, she wanted to do something. So Jada said to her, well, what are you doing tomorrow? She said, well, I'm going on a Groupon swamp tour. And so Jada says to her, okay, well, I think Will and I would like to join you. She says, okay. So she arrives at the hotel in her, she says, $20 a day rental car, thinking she'll get out and get in the limo with them. And they said, no, we'll get in your car. So she's driving thinking, oh my God, please don't let me kill the $6 million man behind me. They get there. And Jada says, who are all these people? She says, well, it's the Groupon. She said, I don't understand what that means. And she says, it means that other people are on the tour. And Jada says, no, I thought it meant that, you know, you just, I didn't understand what it meant. She says, and so the whole story is that rich people don't know about Groupon. So Groupon wisely then hired her as a spokesperson.
And she had some tough times. She lived in the car for a while.
Yes.
So this is the classic... rags to $4,000 dress story.
I love it that she wears that dress all the time.
Why
also,
not?
She and Maya Rudolph, and I am in love with Maya Rudolph. And then otherwise deadly dull Oscars, with a couple of exceptions.
They were good.
They were presenters. Yeah. Here's a little bite of them on the stage.
We are so happy to be here, but a little nervous too, because a few years ago, people were saying that Oscars were so white. And since then, some real progress has been made.
Mm-hmm. But when we came out together, we know some of you were thinking, are the Oscars too black now?
But we just want to say, don't worry. There are so many more white people to come to.
So many. We just came from backstage, and there are tons of them back there.
Tons of them.
I thought they were great. They were pretty funny.
With the $4,000 dress.
You know, staying in the movie industry, I am probably the only person in America who is not head over heels over this inclusion rider thing. And I'm going to tell you why in a minute.
Yeah.
The latest star, Michael B. Jordan, making a pledge that he'll do this. And the thing is demanding in his contract, 50% of the people working in the film are people of color. I think I said this the other day to somebody else with whom we were talking about this issue. If this matters, it shouldn't be up to individual actors to have to demand this. There should be a demand by all actors that the industry standards be that 50% of the people who work on a film, you know what I mean?
I understand what you mean.
I'm not at all criticizing the Jordans of the world, but it's sort of like small potatoes when the big potato is staring you in the face.
Well, here's the thing. It's a huge gap between should be and can.
I guess so.
So if you can close the gap between should be and can and is, then, you know, I'm all for it. And what usually happens is there are no people out front. They wait to see what other people will do. And so here you have Michael B. Jordan, who is really, he couldn't be more at the height of his career. He's just coming off Black Panther. He did Creed. He was in Fruitvale. He's been in a billion movies. He has a billion more coming up. I mean, some might look at that and say, don't rock any boat. Don't say anything.
No, yeah. You're right.
Just let it go. And he's saying, no, you know, I can have a platform and I can do something. And hopefully other people will see that and follow.
Well, you know, if other people of his stature, if 10 of the biggest stars, men and women, people of color, whites, got together and did a press conference and said, here's what we want the industry standard to be.
Yeah.
I think it'd be pretty damn hard for the industry not to accede to the demand. Would you not think so?
I would think so. And, you know, what's weird, and I meant to look this up before I came. 100 years ago, I recall that Clint Eastwood, I don't know if it was a contract, but he had a requirement on one of the films that he made. Clint Eastwood, that there be a lot of diversity behind the camera.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
As an actor, or he became a director later in life?
No, he was directing. And one of his, it may have been several of his movies, but certainly one of them, when he moved into directing. Because, you know, when you're in that chair, you can look around and see what's happening.
So a lot of talk about guns after the Parkland shooting. You had the Florida legislature actually passing some gun legislation. It wasn't big time, but it was something. And we'll wait and see if the governor signs it. But down there, Rick Scott. But anyway, this woman who's Lucy McBath. Lucy McBath, whose son was killed, Jordan Davis, a teenager, has decided to jump into the Georgia race down there, and she's motivated mainly by the inaction in Congress.
Yes, well, people may remember that her son, Jordan Davis, was in a car with a group of kids, and they were, according to the man that shot him to death, playing the music too loudly.
Too loud.
So he shot him to death. He shot into the car and injured others because he thought the music was too loud. Thank God he is serving some time, but you can imagine. After that, you can imagine how, just talk about surreal and how.
Unreal.
Yes. And so here's this woman who lost her son, 17 years old, and she immediately became an activist working about in the area of getting people aware of what gun violence does to the country beyond, you know, her son's death. And so she was raising money to run against a state rep and then thought, you know what? After what happened in Florida, I think I'm up in my game. And if I lose, I lose. But she'd already raised $100,000, so she's going to go against the Karen Handel, who people may remember won in a kind of very tight race with this Ossoff guy.
Yes.
He was a highly...
The Democrat.
It became a big national campaign.
Big race. Right. Yes. He was kind of an uninspired Democrat.
Right.
But there was some hope among the Democrats that he would pull it off, and he didn't.
Months ago, Abigail Disney, who was, I think, the niece of Walt Disney and the daughter of Roy, did a film, The Armor of Light. Was she on our show or just on my television?
She was on our show.
She was. She did a piece, this wonderful story about this white evangelical preacher. Mm. Who was an outcast in the evangelical community because his reading of the Bible was you cannot be pro-life and pro-gun.
Right.
And to say he was an outcast, but the reason I bring him up, it's a great movie, by the way, The Armor of Light, it's called, is one of the people who's featured, who became an ally of his, was Lucy McBath.
Oh,
is featured regularly
right.
in this film, and she's really powerful. And the as you described, the whole situation with her son is unimaginably terrible. And she, from that moment on, became a really powerful activist. And I think it's great she's running. But before people get their hopes too high, the big race that people are focused on today, we discussed it with somebody a few minutes ago. I can't remember which guest it was. We were talking about the race in Southwest.
Bob Cutner,
Southwest Pennsylvania, where in a district that Donald Trump won by 20 points, the Democrat, incredibly, is leading by a few in polls. The voting is on Tuesday. It's important to note that candidate, while he does support universal background checks, the Democrat supports no other gun proposals that are pending either, in any state capital or in the federal capital in
Washington. You know, the RAND Corporation, just because I've been doing a lot of research on guns lately, just did a big study about what happens when concealed carry comes to places and what happens with stand your ground.
That scares me.
And things get worse. That's what happens.
Yeah.
And the legislators down in Florida, African-American legislators, were saying about this teachers getting armed thing, hey, You know, wait a minute. We already have problems with police officers going after unarmed black men. Now we're going to have to worry that the black kids who get suspended more are going to be shot at by people in the schools.
And not to mention, how about how many law enforcement officers have come forward and said, we do not think this is a good idea? Yeah. Period. Because well, we can't tell who's the bad person and not. You
even
know.
The governor of Florida, who
Rick
is a
Scott's
big gun
it.
Guy,
yes.
is saying, and the teachers apparently have all petitioned that we don't want this to happen. So, but the idea that more guns make people more safe, I'm glad that people, because we can't do research because, of course, Congress decided in the Dickey Amendment we can't have the CDC do research on guns and health. But these other places, like the RAND Corporation, like this great website that I'm writing about for the Globe, actually on MondayTrace.com, it only focuses on guns.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not make people more safe. It makes them less
safe. You know, the most recent poll of the American people, though, not teachers.
Half of America.
50% of America, 50 to 42, think arming teachers is a good
idea. Well, I think that the NRA has been very effective in convincing people that this is going to be a good thing. You have all your teachers armed. The teacher can start shooting when the shooter comes in. But the research, what little we have, we do not have much, indicates that that is not true at all.
Well, I don't understand. I guess, and this is where good research would help, is you just can't tell me that even a lot of people who are trained and who might know what to do, some of those people are going to freeze. It's just normal.
Just
look what
it's
happened
just
to
just
Scott
happened,
Peterson
right?
standing outside.
I know. I mean, I just,
hiding
why
outside
is that not a factor? I mean, I don't understand why people don't get that.
I'm
you know?
With you. In any case, talking to Kelly Crossley, can we do a couple of good news things here? Philando Castile, and I assume most people remember Philando Castile.
Black,
killed
black
by
man
a cop
shot by a cop.
During a traffic stop. He was a school nutrition supervisor, and the stories we read about the time of his death is he'd go out of his way, often out of his own pocket, to help kids who were behind, you know, in the little account for to pay for their lunches. Explain what a Philando Castile charity has done in the Minnesota school district where he worked.
Well, a program called launched by Pam Fergus called Philando Feeds the Children raised about $111,000 to help reduce student lunch debt, which the original goal was $5,000. People were so determined to make sure that this happens. And so what it means is that, you know, as this quote says, the Philando Castile Feeds the Children just paid off the lunch debt for all of these kids for the St. Paul Public School System, which has 56 schools. And I don't know how many, and just to go on, it means that no parent of the 37,000 kids who eat meals at school need to worry about how to pay that overdue debt. How many stories have you done, and certainly I've pointed to, where the school cafeteria person slips something to the kid because they can't afford it, and they've been kicked out or lose their jobs or whatever. I mean, this is serious business. They really hold those cafeteria workers to account, and they will not feed those kids if they don't have the money. But the reason they're on the food plan is they don't have the money. So here you have what was a horrible, horrible Facebook Live tragedy, because we recall that his girlfriend, Flando's girlfriend, Facebook Live this as it was happening, turned into something that, you know, certainly he would be proud of, because this is what he did when he was alive, and that those who gave in his name are really feel is meaningful. I mean, you just can't get better than that.
Is the 31,000
except to have him alive, of course.
Is the $31,000 death man considered a good news story? I think it is.
The what?
The Ben Carson story?
Is that what happened to Ben? The $31,000 desk. It's not a dining.
It's
a
dining room table.
Yes,
right.
This is a great. This is a real good news story.
Oh, yeah, well, it is a great.
It's late breaking. This is the one you mentioned.
Breaking news here at Boston Public Radio. We don't get to do it very much, but Ben Carson, who was criticized after a member of his organization's kind of did a whistleblower thing and complained that he had taken language out of HUD's mission statement, which talked about inclusiveness and discrimination-free communities. When that story got out and got widespread criticism, that Ben Carson, the $31,000 dining room table man, has now backpedaled.
Well, he says, what he meant to say was the mission statement was a bit wordy, but he agrees with every word and that he is really about fairness. Well, fairness is in his redone mission statement, so how he interprets fairness, I believe, is the issue. He's already on record for his discriminatory remarks against LGBTQ communities and housing, and, you know, he's the head housing guy. Not to mention many other communities. So we don't know what he's going to do, but I'm going to guess that whatever words end up in this mission statement, he won't be long for supporting them if they were to maintain what it says here currently, which is to create strong, sustainable, inclusive communities and quality, affordable homes for all. I mean, you know, why that has to be changed, I don't know.
Can we digress for a second? You only mentioned this $31,000 desk in passing here, a dining room table, which he allegedly said was not his intention.
Well, he didn't know. He didn't know.
These are short money things in the grand scheme of things.
Oh,
but
the door?
The average poor person who he's supposed to be serving there makes roughly $12,500 a year. So 2.5 times the income of that person is what he wanted to spend for a dining room table.
Right.
Then there's Ryan Zinke, Mr. Interior Department, who is spending $139,000 of your dollars to replace three sets of doors at the Interior Department. Now, their response, at least what I can find so far, is they're historic doors. But the answer is, when you're cutting everything that you are cutting, because this is the mentality of our government, particularly as relates to poor people, not as relates to many others, the notion that they can go to bed at night after having spent $140,000 of our money to replace doors is just, it's unthinkable.
Well, let's get Mr. Pruitt off those planes, those first, you know, I mean, that guy,
what
really?
What do you get in a six-figure door? Is it some, I mean, you think if you got a mahogany door, it wouldn't cost you that much.
They claimed the security people requested it. Listen.
Because everybody's out for Ryan Zinke?
I have no idea. I didn't know he was, you know, a hot property, but whatever.
$139,000.
And you know what? I just want to be on the record saying I'm not one that, you know, you get a government job and you want to make some changes in your office in a reasonable amount of money.
I agree.
I'm not one to deny you that or say you can't change what was there. That's really not me. But $31,000, Ben Carson, your son, your wife are on the payroll, and you're keeping people from having low-income housing? Really?
Yeah.
How many people do you think know that he's the secretary of HUD?
Nobody. Let's do a man on the woman on the street and see what happens.
Exactly.
You'll get nothing.
Okay, so what are you doing Sunday night there, Kelly Crossley?
Well, we have our local news roundtable, and a couple stories we're highlighting is this Springfield cop that has failed three drug tests and has just been given another chance by his boss, which seems a little out of pocket. And also a really interesting story that you can see both sides of. A young junior planner who lives in Brockton is petitioning the city to waive the city requirement residency so he can go, you know, live at home with his parents and get himself out from under crushing student debt. He says he cannot afford to live in Brockton. This is not Boston, people. This is Brockton. This is the reality of millennials' lives right now, that student loan debt is killing folks.
Yeah.
Now, the people that have said on his two appeals, no, we think you can go get a roommate or do something else or cut out something else, you know, they're not people that had the level of crushing student debt that I know my niece and nephew are facing right now. So I think it's a really interesting story from both sides, but I also think, I know it's reality because we did a follow-up on Under the Radar with millennials about, you know, what they are doing just to live. And they have, quote-unquote, good jobs. So this is something that we're going to have to face on all fronts, not just in the private sector, but do you want a brain drain from the government, from somebody who is talented, can do their job? But, hey, hello, yeah. I can't, what do you want me to do here? You know,
he can't afford to live in Boston or Brockton.
Brockton. So this is a very important story on many levels because I know what's happening with that study from the Boston Foundation last year with millennials in town.
Yeah.
Everybody around my round table were either living at home or with five roommates with good jobs.
Yeah, a lot of roommate living. At some point, you get a little tired of the five roommates.
But that's what I'm saying. So now then you get a brain drain. So, you know, this we're talking about that. Oh, in the second half, we're doing this great program that mentors women and young people for the construction industry. All these great jobs, not enough laborers. They're hooking them up. It's great. It's called Construction Mentor Program.
Thank you very much.
Right. Kelly Crossley.
Kelly Crossley joins
Kelly.
Us every week. She's the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here at 89.7 at 6 o'clock. And you can subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Kelly Crossley. Kelly's also the moderator at Basic Black, which follows Beat the Press tonight. 50 years on the air at 7:30 WGBH. Coming up, it's time for our Friday news quiz, a Pledge Master special. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time for our Friday news quiz featuring WGBH pledge master Andy Hicks and a pair of pants that is otherworldly. Maybe he can describe them. He's the producer of On Air Fundraising and Marketing, and Henry Santoro, who, of course, is WGBH news anchor and host extraordinaire. Gentlemen, it's great to see you both.
And great to see you. Do you see what I'm holding in my hands right here?
Oh,
oh my God. The actual smug mug.
I have the actual smug mug that I brought with me.
It's even worse.
From headquarters.
Can I see that while you're doing this?
Jim, you should be arrested.
I'm serious.
Doesn't he look like a suspicious character?
He really does look like a suspicious character.
Okay, he's got very nice teeth over there. I don't know why he doesn't smile.
Horrible.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, Eddie, it's really not the best picture I've ever seen of Jim. He should be smiling.
I think Jim looks like he is skeptical. Like he's like, now, Mr. Mayor, you mm-hmm. don't really mm-hmm.
don't
tell
think
me
so.
This.
Nice
so
try,
so.
Andy.
No, you look wonderful. You look wonderful. Marjorie looks great, too.
And I love the way he's got his nose in the air. That's my favorite thing. He's looking
He looks like he's about to steal a Tesla.
No, this is after I stole the Tesla, actually. By the way, and look at the picture. You know what's worse? I don't want to belabor this, but it is aggravating me.
I don't blame you. I'd be aggravated, too,
Is it an
too,
embarrassingly
Jim.
Horrible picture of me? Mm-hmm. Is it maybe the best picture of you ever?
It's a great picture.
That is a stunning photo.
Oh, my God. I need one of those for posterity so that when I'm in the old folks' home, I'll say, you know, there was a time when I looked better than I do now.
Back in the day, absolutely.
If you were left-handed, you can greet your day with a beautiful picture of Marjorie. If you're right-handed, you get Jim. That's fine.
That's right.
You know, but yeah.
And I just want to ask, you guys are still celebrating your fifth anniversary at WGBH.
Yes, we are.
We are, of course we are.
Well, I brought a little gift for you from Italy. These are biscotti that you
can have with your Dean's beans.
And your new mug. So, Jim, I'll hand those to you.
Thank you very much.
To the office.
Very nice.
I just want you to know that since you've been at GBH,
yes.
radios have been selling like crazy.
Absolutely.
My parents sold theirs. My next door neighbor sold theirs.
Thank you very much.
But enough.
He's in the lounge on Thursday night. You should try the veal, too, when you go there.
Okay.
But if you are still listening on the radio, we should mention very quickly, again, $12.50 a month. We'll say thanks for the brand-new Boston Public Radio Smug Mug. It goes away at 2 p.m. You have exactly 27 and a half minutes to get your smug mug. Please call 888-897-9424 or give online at wgbhnews.org.
Now, we're going to start the news quiz in just a second, but we have a news quiz lifelines, and this is very important for both of you. Derry from Concord in the flowered shirt over there. There she
is. Hi, Derry. How are you?
Likes to get her politics from Boston Public Radio. That's very good. It makes us very happy.
Hey, wait. Derry, can I ask you a question if you like your politics? What would you say of this photograph about? How would you describe this photo? Can you see it from there?
Dashing.
There you go. Very
Obviously,
dashing.
She is not to be trusted. Who's the other lifeline?
Monica from Andover. Monica has no power and escaped the library. That's what she said.
By the way, come to the mic, Monica. Is it true? I think I heard on our station this morning, much of Andover is out at least for the weekend. Is that true?
Well, 90% is out.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, what do you think of the photograph, by the way, of me? Not her. What do you think?
I plead the fifth.
Thank you. Exactly. One honest woman in this particular discussion. Now, the way this works, do you have any idea how the way the lifeline works?
Yes, I do, because they wrote it right in the screen.
What happens?
We ask the question.
Yes.
And we ask for the lifeline clue if neither of these guys can think of the answer.
Oh, so they could get a second clue,
right.
as that works.
Then they answer the question they have the clue.
Can I ask you, I really don't want to get... What is with the pants? I mean, those are horrible.
They're not horrible.
What is up with that?
I bought these pants for a costume, and it's laundry day.
That's
the answer.
That's just a version from the mug.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're very nice pants. They're very exciting. You know, from a guy who looks like this picture of the smug mug thing, I don't know if you're in
a position
to be critical.
I have a new sweatshirt today, but it's brand new. I got it yesterday in the mail.
What's he got on? He's got a sweatshirt with a scarf around his neck.
I think I look rather... Excuse me?
Okay.
You want to start this thing?
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Where do you want to start? I'll start with Henry.
Okay.
Okay. Right. You ready, Henry?
Henry, I have a question
Henry
first.
Santoro.
Yes, sir.
If you're really dedicated, this is my view of news people like mm-hmm. you, if you're mm-hmm. really dedicated to your job and not just a big talker,
okay. mm-hmm.
you do the news from the elevator. I mean, that's the way it's got to be in 2018.
I have done the news from stranger places than that.
Than Joe Matthew did the other day?
An hour and a half.
Is that a true story that he did an hour and a half? He was locked on the elevator for an hour and a half?
That is a very true story, which is why now the front doors will be open at 3:30.
Beautiful thing. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt the question.
A blessing in disguise.
Oh, is that why no one could rescue him?
Yeah.
Because
they couldn't get into the building.
They couldn't get into the building.
Yeah, because it was at before the time, I think.
Because he's on the air at 4:50.
So if you want to prevent our elevators from breaking down, $12.50 a month is a great way to support WGBH and help keep the lights and the elevators working. WGBHnews.org or 888-897-9424. We'll say thanks with that smug mug, but it goes away in 24 minutes.
Thank God. Let's do a news quiz. Don't want to miss it. Okay, Henry, you ready?
I'm ready, Marjorie.
ABC's reality show The Bachelor shocked viewers during its finale this week by broadcasting a 30-minute-long unedited scene of what? This is multiple choice. A, The Bachelor breaking up with his fiance and getting back together with the runner-up. B, The Bachelor going on an extended rant about how fake and immoral the show is. C, The Bachelor going to the meats section of the local Whole Foods and sticking his finger through the plastic, which is something that Mr. Smug Mug, Jim Browdy, has
brought
to an art form. Now, if you don't know, you can ask for the lifeline clue if you're not sure what
the
answer is.
Why don't you ask for it? Do you want a little help?
Because this is a news quiz, not the Bachelor. We're talking about the
so
we start
who's
with the Bachelor.
Giving him the extra clue? You are, Monica? Yeah. What's the extra clue for Henry, please?
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Let's hope that, unlike the Bachelor, you don't have a second thoughts about your answer.
Oh, that's right. Well, yeah, I was going to say anyway.
A is correct.
Very good.
Now, can I comment on this?
Yes.
I cannot tell why I do not watch The Bachelor. However, do you know that this has risen to such a big story?
Yes.
The Washington Post, I would argue the best paper in the United States, has done a series of follow-up stories on the public's reaction to this slime ball. What's his name? Ari or something?
I don't know his name.
Who
I dumped
heard the
what
woman
was happening.
And then asked that the dumping be filmed and broadcast on television. I mean, what do you think of that, Andy?
I think it's horrible.
Thank you.
I think that it's it was a mugging is what it was.
Beautifully put.
Thank you.
Andy had his first date with the one that he chose. Last night,
she spent the entire time just being like that jerk and drinking. It was really
how I know
awkward.
That I have no
awkward.
Idea.
Oh, but anyway, okay. $12.50 a month. We'll say thanks for that smug mug.
Okay, here's the first question to you, Andy, right, to tie this thing up. Which fast food franchise changed their logo yesterday in celebration of International Women's Day? It's A, was it Burger King, who changed their signature crown into a tiara and called the franchise Burger Queen for the day? B, was it McDonald's, who flipped their golden arches upside down so it became a W for women? Or C, was it Wendy's, which changed their mascot from a young red-haired girl with pigtails into a red-headed, successful single mother lawyer wearing a pantsuit? And before you answer, would you like Derry to give you a lifeline?
I actually know the answer to this.
Oh, you don't even need her
off on the lifeline. Well, does she have another?
Do you have a lifeline for him? I think he does.
I would love to hear.
I think he's overconfident. Yeah. What is it exactly, Derry?
Okay, customers of this franchise were really loving it.
Oh, God, that is one. It's an incredible clue, Derry. Thank you very much. She's from Concord. What's the answer?
I think the answer is B.
That is correct.
Yes. So,
what'd you think of that gesture? We talked about that yesterday.
That was horrendous.
Thank you. Okay, well, give him an extra half.
Okay. Question three, Henry. Stacey A. Smith got her 15 minutes of fame this week for what? A, she is the kayaker in southern Florida who was attacked by the oriental small clawed otter. B, she came up with the inclusion rider popularized at the Oscars. Or C, she is the British lawmaker who ended the KFC shortage.
Wow.
Would you like to go to your lifeline?
I will take a lifeline
okay.
on this
we
one.
Okay, we ready over there?
Yes.
Who is it, Monica?
Okay, this is Monica.
Yes. Go ahead, Monica.
Okay, are you ready? If you get this right, you'll win an all-inclusive trip to NPR's headquarters.
Ooh. You get that clue?
Do you want me to say it again?
Yeah, why don't you say it three or four more times? Go ahead. Go ahead, read it again.
If you get this right, you'll win an all-inclusive trip to NPR's headquarters.
I tell you, the accentuation
inclusive
to that was
is
brilliant.
The crucial
it was
thing.
Really fabulous, Monica.
You
thank
ready?
Do
you want me to repeat
the question? What are the
okay.
ABC again?
The kayaker who was attacked by the oriental small clawed otter.
Yep.
The woman who came up with the inclusion rider popularized at the Oscars.
Ridiculous.
Or the British lawmaker went to the KFC shortage.
It is B again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
There you go. That was a good one, Monica. Okay, ready, Andy?
Can I say something else here?
Yep.
There were a lot of not such great photographs of me that they could have used that would have made the same point without picking the single worst photograph. Yep. You don't think that to be true?
I think that there's somebody here who doesn't like you, Jim. That's what I think.
You do think that, do
I
you
do
not?
I think you've been sabotaged.
It's not just about helping GBH raise money. It's about getting me.
I happen to know who created that mug.
Who was it?
I can't tell you.
Thank you.
No.
He's in this room.
No.
Okay. Andy, here is your question to tie it up, which would make it 2-2 going into the bonus round. The Catholic Church is unable to supply enough resources for this daily demand. A, communion wafers after they were eaten as snacks in the film Lady Bird. B, exorcisms because too many young priests say they're too scared to perform them. Or C, altar wine after the Trump administration inspired one too many post-mass happy hours. And I'm not even going to ask you if you need a clue because you do. And Dari is the one to provide it. Dari, out here, please?
Yes.
Go ahead.
The power of Christ compels the church to recruit more staff for this task.
That's a clue? Okay. I mean, it's not her fault. She's reading what she was given. Gary, that was excellent.
Well, the power of our producer over here it compels me to remind you the number is 888-897-9424. Mm-hmm. WGBHnews.org. You can give either way. $12.50 a month for the mug. And the answer is, I was going to say A, love the movie, love that scene. But what were the other two again?
Exorcisms, because too many young priests say they're too scared to perform them. Or C, altar wine. B, I'm sorry.
Communion wafers was A.
C is altar wine after the Trump administration inspired one too many post-mass happy hours. Is it B? You don't like A, so is it B or C?
And the power of Christ compels the thing with the, yeah, C. C? No. Oh, okay.
But, no, Henry, you can steal this and plunge into the lead.
It's B.
Because
it is B. Ding, ding, ding.
I was like, but staffing? But
that was fabulous. So do you want to tell us anything about Pledge before we go to the bonus round, you two? What do you want to tell us?
Well, I do want to say that Jim and Marjorie.
Oh, by the way, Dari and Monica, you were fabulous. Thank you. Let's hear it for them. Fabulous. We hope you get power soon, Monica, too. Go ahead.
I do want to say that Jim and Marjorie being here and having this beautiful place here at the Boston Public Library is just such a great testament to, I think, what you two mean to your audience and what you mean to the city. And the reason that we come on the air to interrupt all the time during Jim and Marjorie's show is because we know people give because they love Jim and Marjorie.
Oh, wow.
And people who love Jim and Marjorie love public radio that has interesting conversations, sounds a little bit different, and sort of, you know, pulls the entire community together, focuses on the world, focuses on the city, focuses on the state, focuses on everything in your life. So please make that call now, 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. We have an entire library here full of people who are going to break library rules by doing a round of applause for all the people who have given so far.
Thank you so much.
We'd love to
awesome.
Do that. Please make that call. $12.50 a month. You have about 17 minutes to pick up the Smug Mug. It goes away at 2 p.m.
How many mugs are there? How many different
Not
variations
of the Smug
of
Mug?
The Jim and Marjorie mugs are there.
There are two Smug Mugs. This is the second one. This is smuggier than the first one.
It is.
It's really smuggy.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to need a Jim and Marjorie trophy case for these things.
No, our intention is to keep doing this.
They are collectibles.
Collectibles.
Because when they go away, like in 20 minutes from now, or less than 20
less
minutes
than that.
From now, they're gone.
They're gone. That's right.
888-897-9424. Get your hands on this mug right now or WGBHnews.org. Mm.
Do you have a first one, by the way? Do you have one of the first ones? I have a couple in my car.
I do. I only have one, and I treasure it. And I'm going to get my hands on one of these, too, because, you know, I get a lot of mileage out of this, I think. The smuggiest ever.
So should we do the bonus round?
I'm ready for the bonus
Why
round.
Why not?
Here's the bonus round.
Are we heading a bonus round already?
Here's the premise. What's the score, judges, by the way? Oh, that's horrible. Henry, you're leading 3, and Andy, you only have 1 point.
No, I have 2 points.
No, you actually, you don't. Now, the premise of the bonus round is this.
How does he have 3 points?
If you were listening, I'm the judge and the jury.
Fine. Okay.
If you were listening to BPR during Pledge Drive, 3 full hours of Pledge, you must be a real NPR junkie. Is that not correct, Marjorie?
Absolutely.
So this one is for the BPR listeners, testing you. Oh, God, I hate this. You and your Jim and Marjorie trivia. And if Henry and Andy blow this, they'll be outed for never listening to the show.
That's exactly right. Those are the rumors that we hear. Okay, go ahead, Jim. Or I should start with this.
You do the first one. But
okay.
Who do you ask?
I'm
going
to go to Andy. We're going to switch it up now. Right. Andy, here we go. Jim describes himself as the number one fan in America of whom?
Oh, I know the answer.
A. Jeffrey Toobin. Mm-hmm. B. Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. C. Richard Henderson, winner of the 2017 Nobel Prize in Chemistry, quote, for developing cryo-electron microscopy for the high-resolution structure determination of biomolecules in the solution.
Yes.
That is really specific.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. B's Gandhi doesn't seem like a gym kind of guy.
No, I don't think so either.
A or C. I'm gonna go a C because there's so much of a description there. No.
This is
not only does he not listen to the show, he doesn't even know who we are.
Okay.
So do you know what the answer
to
the question is?
Well, I am forced to listen to the show every day because I'm your news guy.
You have no choice.
I have no choice but to listen.
That is an excellent point. He has no choice.
It is, of course, Jeffrey Toobin.
Jeffrey Toobin.
Ding, 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 ding.
Absolutely, that was
remember
great.
When he was on our show? You have no recollection of that, do you, Marjorie?
Jeffrey Toobin? Yes, I do.
So.
He wrote a book. Yeah. And he was on our show pushing the book. I love him. He's
actually,
very smart.
That's not true, but that's close enough.
Well, why was he here then?
What?
He was here because of his book.
Okay. Now, right. Here is the... here's the next question. This is also hard. Why are they... This is horrible. This is for you. Who's the question? Henry, for you.
Henry, yeah.
Who is christened Tiny Tears by a school headmaster? A, Marjorie Egan, that'd be her right there. B, that'd be Jim Browdy, that's me, with a photograph on the mug. Or C, both. Let me read the question again. Who is christened Tiny Tears by a school headmaster? Who would that be, Henry, please?
I am going to go with Marjorie.
Wow.
Jim is Tiny Tears.
Wait
Tiny
a second. Tears. No, it could be both of us.
Could be both of you.
Oh, I blew it.
That seems like a very specific thing, again, unless you went to the same school and had the same headmaster.
It's a very good point.
It's got to be B.
Yeah,
it's got to
be B.
That is very good.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's
the
last one.
By the way, why do you revel in that story?
I don't revel.
Yes, you do. You've told the story like 500 times, even though neither Andy or Henry ever heard the story.
No, it's a good story about you.
I revel in telling people a phone number and website.
What is it?
That's right. It's 888-897-9424, wgbhnews.org. Please give. You have 13 minutes
to get the smug mug.
Dear God.
Now, before we have, by the way, the show, we have 6 minutes left, Marjorie, so we got to fill some time here.
Yep.
And so why don't I tell the story of why I was Tiny Tears? Sure, Jim, why don't you?
Go ahead.
So I went to a private school for 4 years. It was a friend's school,
yes.
Since you asked. And I went from fourth to eighth grade. And whenever you did something you shouldn't do.
This is when you were a portly kid, too,
I was portly. I was portly. I wasn't portly. I was bigger than portly. I shopped in the portly department at Jacob Reed's, which was humiliating, which is why I'm an advocate for healthier whatever.
Yeah. In Philly.
In Philadelphia, where I grew up. That is correct. Every time you're sent down to the office, what was the name of the headmaster, Marjorie?
Master Jack.
Master Jack was his name. You called the men by master and their first name. Women were teacher and whatever. Every time
I would go down there.
Yeah, I actually would take a few more minutes to tell the story. And every time I would go down there, Master Jack, because I'd be crying, because the third time you're sent to the headmaster, your mother has to come get you.
Yeah.
Oh. And she had to leave work and everything. And I would be crying.
Okay.
And in a crass way, I'm almost done.
It's an American tragedy.
In a crass way, he would refer to me as Tiny Tears. What do you think of that?
I think we could have done without it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, I think what you need to do is you need to march down to Philadelphia with that mug in hand and say, headmaster, look
how far I've come. How do you get the mug, by the way?
$12.50 a month for the mug, 888-897-9424, wgbhnews.org.
Excellent.
Okay, here we go. Here's going to wrap this baby up here.
Are you leaving early or something? What's the rush here?
Get the question in.
Okay, fine.
Okay. This is about me. What is Marjorie Egan's fantasy retirement plan? A, returning to Fall River, my hometown, to volunteer for my childhood church's youth group.
Mm-hmm.
B, holing up on Cape Cod with Harry the Pea, the best dog from C2C. That would, of course, be my ancient little dog. Or C, sitting on my front porch with a bong.
This is the easiest question ever asked on the quiz.
A, B, or C, Andy? Catholic Church, Harry the P on the Cape Cod, or the bong on the porch?
Everybody knows.
You know, honestly, C sounds amazing.
Yes.
yeah. And that would be anybody's porch.
But you know, I don't have to worry about it anymore because now that we have legalized marijuana,
right.
I figure that by the time I get to be in the old folks' home, I'll be able to get my own bong. I won't have to depend on the police commissioner who volunteered to bring me one.
Because
he was against legalized marijuana, as everybody else was.
Well, yeah, so. maybe next pledge drive, that'll be the big thank you gift. But right now, $12.50 a month for the WGBH Smug Mug, the BPR, $12.50 a month. Again, that is about 10 minutes away from vanishing from before your very eyes.
Oh, goodness.
888-897-9424.
You know, I'm looking at this mug. And
why don't you take it, actually, if
well,
you don't mind.
If I hold this just right, Chip, doesn't she look like Nicole Kidman?
That's right.
In all seriousness,
it's
one of the most beautiful photographs I've ever seen. She looks unbelievable.
I was looking at it, and I was like, who does she look like? If you hold it just right,
you know what the
you
problem
look just
is?
Like Nicole Kidman.
You know what the problem is with a picture like that? Yeah. That then people see you in person, and they kind of say.
Oh, that's not true. That's
Jim,
not
right. Come on now.
I look like Tom Cruise.
Ted Bundy.
Okay. Give us a pledge one more time, Andy.
Anthony Hopkins,
wrap this
maybe.
888-897-9424,
WGBHnews.org.
Look at my forehead, too. The whole thing is a disaster.
A little Hannibal Lecter vibe.
Go ahead.
On. That's fine.
Yeah.
Again, that's $12.50 a month, and we really do hope that you do pitch in and make that call, make that contribution. Jim and Marjorie are here because you listen and because people contribute, because people are kind. It's about one gift at a time, people doing what they can. We hope that you join them.
Well, you know what I always say, too? Mm-hmm. That if you didn't have these pledge breaks, which I know are hard, we would have commercials.
Yeah.
Endless commercials.
Endless commercials.
We've worked on commercial radio. They are endless.
Oh, I worked in commercial radio for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I'm glad I'm out.
Yeah. You could go out for a three-course meal while the commercials were on. I mean, they really go on forever. Yeah. So think about how horrible that would be. And it's worth listening to us make fun. And it's worth of Jim being a good sport about the smug mug.
And so we have only 9 minutes and the mug is gone. I read. What's the number one last time?
888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. Make that call. It's $12.50 a month. As a sustainer, we really hope that we can say thanks to you.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It.
Yeah, thank you
Let's
very
hear
much
it for Andy and Henry. Andy yes,
Henry.
Indeed. Ding, ding, ding.
Henry Santoro is a WGBH news anchor and host. That's his voice you hear every day giving the news when we are on the air. Andy Hicks is WGBH producer of On Air Fundraising and Marketing. Henry and Andy, thank you very much. And Andy, I like your pants.
Thank you so much.
Horrible.
It's very great to have you
horrible.
Here.
It was
fun, Henry, to have you here, too. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can catch our podcast on iTunes. I actually got it for free on the App Store. And it's our podcast. I hope you like it. You can catch us live on Monday for Politics, Global Affairs, and Bob Thompson's TV Roundup. We're going to be here next week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday at the Boston Public Library, not Wednesday next week. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boygon, Christina Bieni. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. We're a production of WGBH. I want to thank everybody that came down to the library today.
Thank you all for coming.
Really
we really appreciate it. Thank you all.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Oh, well, I am Jim Browdy.
Yes, you are, otherwise known as Tiny Tears.
Thank you.
Glad to hear that one again. Thank you for tuning in. Have a wonderful weekend, and please tune again on Monday.
Thank you.